You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Seth Kirschner. Seth Kirschner is a writer and researcher whose work has appeared in outlets like In These Times and Sojourners and Rethinking Schools, and he is the co-author with Scott Harding of a terrific new book called Counter-Recruitment and the Campaign to Demilitarize Public Schools, which he tells me is the first book to analyze the grassroots counter-recruitment movement, which has been around for more than 40 years. Seth Kirschner, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me.
That's incredible to me that nobody has written a book. Certainly people have written endless blog posts about counter-recruitment, which has been around for forever.
Right. Well, there was, I should just add that there was a very good sort of activist guidebook that was a how-to guide on how to get involved with counter-recruitment, and that came out in 2007. It was Amy Allison, David Solnit from Seven Stories Press. It's very good, but it didn't really analyze the movement and didn't look at the aspects of it that Scott and I were examining. So that's why I say it's really the first to examine this in depth.
Counter-recruitment is a familiar term to me. It's a familiar movement. I've been in touch with people doing it and done it for many years, but I think to many people it's a confusing phrase, don't even know what it means. And the idea that U.S. schools are militarized may be confusing. So maybe we should start there with what does it mean to say that schools in the United States need to be demilitarized?
Well, yeah, I think we should just step back a bit and start with the state of school militarism. And that's a bit of jargon, I realize, but by saying school militarism, I'm just referring to the military's integration with public schools especially, but the educational system K through 12 especially. Scott and I don't look at ROTC programs at universities. That's a whole other kettle of fish. So, yeah, I think it would be helpful to start with the K through 12 educational system, how that's become pretty well integrated with the military, because there is a fair bit of lack of awareness about this.
How has it become integrated with the military?
Well, as soon as the draft ended in 73, you began to see three different types of this military integration take hold in high schools. You began to see recruiters gain access to schools to talk with youth, and that varied wildly between schools. So in some cases, recruiters would be there a lot. In other cases, they would not. But you would have a recruiter setting up a table and having conversations with students. And then you also have an expansion of the junior ROTC program. And then along with that, you have the increase in military testing programs, so that by the mid-70s, you have about 1.3 million high school students being tested across the country, doing the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. So you have recruiters talking to students in schools, these military training programs, junior ROTC, and then the ASVAB, or the testing program. And all of that expanded in the 70s because the military needed to have access to manpower, and youth and advertising, marketing, school access began to be the priority.
How much are we taxpayers forking over for these efforts?
Well, just to give an example, I mean, the junior ROTC program, which is in around 3,500 high schools, that cost, the most recent figures that I have, 2009, so this needs to be updated, but it cost over $320 million for this program, which the military in public and to schools and to parents, military claims this is not a recruiting program. This is a citizenship training program. Got
yeah.
that?
Citizenship training. So if you don't get trained to follow orders and shoot stuff, you're not a good citizen.
Right. So it's absurd on its face, but nevertheless, people continue to believe this. It's quite. This is a program that if you didn't have it in your high school, it would almost not even believe that it could exist. Right. That you would have students dressing up in uniforms, marching around campus. In some programs, not every program, but in some, you do have the rifle training. They use air guns. So all this is happening, again, because it's citizenship education. But there have been a number of studies that are done that show that there's a direct, there is this link between a student's participation in JROTC and their decision to enlist in the military. That's pretty strong. The connection between the other things the military claims happen in JROTC, like reducing the dropout rates or increasing academic achievement, the evidence for that is pretty slim, according to studies.
So we have the military in the schools, we have the training programs, ROTC in the schools, and we have these tests. Who is working to counter these things, and how are they going about it?
Well, you have this behemoth on the one side where you have all these resources, millions of dollars going into recruiting programs and marketing programs to make sure that the roughly 200,000 new bodies enter the military every year. That's on one side. And the other side, you have a mostly volunteer band of grassroots activists, parents, a lot of veterans. During the Iraq War years, there were a fair number of students who were involved in this work. And what they're trying to do is to blunt the impact of the military in high schools. And they do that in a number of ways. If anyone's out there has heard of counter-recruitment, you might associate it with this very common form, which is kind of like consumer advocacy. Activists go into high schools, and the courts have established that they have a right to do that. They go into high schools, they bring literature, and they set up tables, kind of like a military recruiter does. And they share information about what the military is really like. They talk about options that don't involve the military for students who just need college funding, right? And this is all made necessary because, as a lot of the counter-recruiters told us, the high schools they're working in have guidance counselors, but they're extremely overworked. And these guidance counselors, they might have 700 students to be responsible for, right? And they have to then prioritize the ones who are going to go to college. So the students who aren't interested in college don't really get the guidance, so they don't know about other options out there. They don't know about city year programs, which can give you a stipend and other kinds of benefits to do work in urban areas. They don't know about these other options. All they hear about, because the military is there every week, is you can get all these great scholarships if you join up, right? You can get all these benefits if you sign this contract. So they're there as a counter presence to tell the other side of the recruiting pitch.
You have some great stories in the book, dialogue conversations that counter-recruiters, including veterans, have had with potential recruits. Does it work, and what works best?
Right, that's a great question. So this is the most common form, the form of counter-recruitment I just described, which some people call truth in recruiting. It's the most common form because it's the easiest lift, you could say. All you have to do is get some literature, brochures and pamphlets, call some people at the school, and you can set up an appointment. And if you have a group of people, it's easier to do that. But we know of, you know, single individuals who go into schools and do this. So this is easy work, and you feel good afterwards, activists tell us. It's gratifying to have these conversations with youth, but you really have no idea what kind of impact you're having, particularly long-term. So it's
Sometimes you do, right? Sometimes you have the immediate gratification of changing someone's mind and convincing someone to back out of the military, right?
That's right. Yeah. So you sometimes activists will tell us that they have had conversations with students who were on the fence or confused about something a recruiter had told them, and they get some information, and that does then lead to them making a decision to, you know, spend the extra time filling out a FAFSA form and getting some financial aid for college instead of doing what the military recruiter tells them to do. And then sometimes you have youth who come back years later and they say, hey, thanks for that conversation. It changed my mind, right? So there is that. That does happen. And plus, like you said, there's this intangible just sense of gratification that is important, right? It keeps us going as activists. It keeps us going to feel good about what we're doing and to have these face-to-face interactions. Other activists told us that just going into schools and having these interactions with students is a more concrete way of doing something about war and militarism, right? If you just are sending letters to legislators, you rarely get any kind of response. If you're doing a vigil, maybe you'll get some people to honk their horn at you, but it can be a little bit isolating. So this work in the schools is gratifying in that sense.
Yeah. We're speaking with Seth Kirshner, whose book is Counter Recruitment and the Campaign to Demilitarize Public Schools. Sorry, Seth, what, you were about to say something?
Well, I was just going to add that there are other activists who are in this work, and what they're actually trying to do is do something along policy lines, because you can get into schools all you want, but remember, these activists are volunteers, and the military has millions of dollars that they put into recruiting, and in many cases, they can send recruiters to schools on a weekly basis. Counter-recruiters can't match that. So there really is no equal access here in that sense. So what some counter-recruiters are trying to do is lobby school boards, talk to parents, and get policies passed at the school district level, sometimes the state level, that put some regulations in place. So, for instance, in Santa Barbara, there was just a policy passed that limits the number of times recruiters can visit. If nothing like that's in place, recruiters have carte blanche to come in as often as they want, and we know that they will because they have the resources to do that.
And you've seen some significant successes, including a decrease in the number of students being given these military tests, the ASVAB tests. We had Pat Elder on the program who works on this, and it takes longer, of course, but there have been some legislative victories in terms of getting testing out of schools that is very deceptively presented to students as something other than a military recruitment exam.
That's right, yes. And I mentioned earlier that, you know, the high watermark for military testing in schools was the mid-70s, about 1.3 million nationwide. That's been cut in half over the years. And it's been cut in half because of sustained pressure from activists. And this will surprise you. The other big thing that cut that number down is a campaign by a Republican congressman from Ohio in the 70s. He worked with the ACLU, and he really did a number on the ASVAB and helped to rein it in and got those student privacy protections that Pat Elder has been working so effectively with. None of that would have happened if it hadn't been for this congressman from Ohio.
And probably if it hadn't been for the general culture and mood of the country in the 70s, when peace was more acceptable and war was less normal, and it was possible to advance such causes, I assume. And I hope that your book is part of reinvigorating this part of the peace movement, and the whole movement is somehow reinvigorated. But it was a different world back then, was it not?
Yes, it was, and that was something that really surprised us. It was one of the more interesting discoveries, doing this historical research and finding out that we have Republicans in Congress, but most notably you had the Congressional Black Caucus and people like Ron Dellums of California and Perrin Mitchell from Maryland. These congressmen were anti-militarist, and they were proud to say so. They spoke in Congress about the JROTC in particular. This was one of Perrin Mitchell's big issues, and he worked with the American Friends Service Committee in Maryland. So they have that happening in Congress, but in the mainstream churches, for example, Pennsylvania Council of Churches in 1977, I think, passed a resolution against J. Rotzi. Who can imagine that happening today? I mean, the mainstream churches just don't really touch this kind of stuff today.
And of course, they're all still officially on record demanding the total abolition of war from back in the 1920s. It just depends how long an institution has been around, what it's favored, because the whole culture changes, it seems. I think you give some examples in your book of teachers and guidance counselors without any military prompting or connection or funding, guide people toward ROTC. Why don't you go into ROTC as an alternative to physical education? Or why don't you look at the military as sort of a normal accepted thing? There was an article on truthout.org a couple weeks back of someone complaining that their kid's teacher in kindergarten had given them a worksheet where they pick which branch of the military they'd have the most fun in. And the culture just does this voluntarily at this point, right?
That's right. And it's like that Truthout piece points out, it's diffuse. It's not always in a big, highly funded system. It just trickles down to the classroom level where you have teachers promoting this. There is quite a bit of support among educators for junior ROTC, junior ROTC. They believe that it's great for kids who maybe need to be brought in line, and it's a good promoter of discipline and things like that. There's one study I saw that showed that educators feel more that J. Rotzi is more effective at doing these things than J. Rotzi instructors themselves, which kind of is interesting, right? I mean, so that needs to change. And one of the things that we have, that Scott and I in our writing have talked about, is that there are ways to deal with this. And counter recruiters are strapped for time. They don't have as many resources as the military, but one of the things they could do to deal with the level of teacher support for these programs is to speak to teachers in the pre-service training programs in schools of education. This used to be done a little bit more frequently than it is now. I don't know of any group that nowadays goes into schools of education, graduate level education courses, to talk about militarism in education and why that's a problem. And I think when that had been done, like Rick Jonkow's group used to do that in San Diego back in the 80s, they reported good results, because what would happen is those teachers would then graduate, they'd get their teaching credential, having heard these presentations about the military and schools and why that's an issue, and then when they get into schools, they're more critical of those programs, and they're more willing to work with counter recruiters and to facilitate their entry into schools. So it's really a long term strategy, and so I think that's why sometimes activists don't think immediately of doing these things, but it really does have an effect. Yeah, positive one.
Yeah, history teachers in particular need a complete re-education and preparation for the textbooks they're going to be handed, I think. Another part of counter-recruitment that you discuss in the book is recruitment stations and picketing and protesting at recruitment stations. Is that part of counter-recruitment?
Well, there's crossover there, and we describe picketing recruiting stations is one form of an approach to counter-recruitment that sees this activism as trying to end a war. So you saw this in the Iraq War, for example, when a lot of new people were brought into this movement because they had become disillusioned with traditional forms of protest. They had gone to Washington. They saw it didn't make an impact. And what they were thinking of trying to do was to cut off the supply of troops that would be sent to battle. And if you just talk to enough students and show them the information, it would have that effect. Well, and then picketing recruiting stations was another way of doing that. But that's kind of a double-edged sword. Picketing recruiting stations gets you some media attention. If that's an event that the media will come out and cover, and maybe you can get some messages into the media, but that often stirs up a lot of reaction from conservative elements in the community. And we heard this from counter-recruiters in Texas, for example, who were really reluctant to have any kind of picket outside of a recruiting station, just because in that state in particular, but really all over the country, the military is the most revered institution. We all know this. And that's not to say we need to handle it with kid gloves, no. But if you want to be strategic about making gains in your community, and if you live in a conservative community, all that has to be taken into account. And I think now that the war is over, or the war has died down and those sorts of things, I think you are not going to see as many recruiting station pickets. But it's true. They were effective in closing some down. They did close down some stations.
I think it's a very interesting question, as there's a couple sides to it. But can we back up a second to the war is over? Which war is over?
Yeah, that was a...
No, I mean, it's a common delusion, but which war is over? Because I think for a lot of peace activists whose primary concern is, you know, the killing of human beings, and of course, over 90% of the human beings getting killed in U.S. wars are not from the United States. They're the people who live in the country where the war is taken to. They get killed the same if you use robotic drones. They get killed the same if you arm and train proxies. They get killed the same if the U.S. troops are managing not to die in as huge numbers. They still get killed the same. And we have a president bragging about the seven nations he's bombed, while being given credit for having ended the wars that are over. It's a very strange situation, unless your goal isn't really... I mean, you point out in the book that, I think this is a quote, a lot of counter-recruiters are careful to suggest that the military serves a legitimate purpose. Mm-hmm. Now, this bewilders me. Why are they trying to keep people out of the military, unless it's sort of not in my backyard, go get your cannon fodder in the next town, but not this town? Why? Why keep people out of the military if you think the military is doing something good?
Right, yeah, it's a very careful use of language. And if you look to, again, the historical perspective here is interesting because...
Careful meaning dishonest, meaning that they don't actually think that the military is doing something good?
Well, in talking to a lot of these activists, they were, in most cases, they were upfront about saying, we're not against the military. We see there being some legitimate purpose, but they thought it was too large, and they thought that it was completely inappropriate to have recruiters recruiting 17, 16-year-olds. And so that's really what they're focusing on. And you have to pick your battles. I mean, there are no... they can't do everything, these activists, so they're sort of focusing on schools because this is an area where they feel they can have the most impact.
Yeah.
And, I think that's a debate that needs to be had, though, right? What purpose does the military serve, and should we really be saying that we have nothing against the military and then be doing this counter-recruitment work? Does that make sense? So... But these activists who are trying to do these long-term campaigns, in many cases they are trying to bring in a coalition, and to bring in a coalition you've got to go and reach those who are not radicals. And for better or worse, that radical viewpoint is one that you're expressing. It's perceived as radical, that military doesn't serve a purpose and is illegitimate, right? So, but I think... The counter-recruiters have caught some flack for that.
What would free college do for counter-recruitment? I mean, it seems to me a huge number of potential recruits are looking at the college, including the dishonest promises of money for college that recruiters are handing out. What would that do, and would that be an even bigger legislative victory for counter-recruitment?
I think it would be a huge legislative victory for counter-recruitment. I think it would be interesting to see what's happening in Tennessee around enlistments. I would be interested to look at the data there because, of course, as you know, they have the they're experimenting with the free community college program there. So, yeah, we all know that the big draw for a lot of new recruits, not all, but for a lot of these new recruits is money for college and health benefits and insurance and all these things that would be just a birthright if we lived in a society that cared for its citizens, right? But you don't have that. So you have the military serving these kind of as a welfare state. And which I think is why when we look at the data on military recruiter visits, I'm seeing there are a lot of visits to these schools in places where 80% of the students qualify for free or reduced price lunch, where the students are going to be more receptive to this message of help for college, financial assistance, insurance, things like that. So it's a cynical, it's a sort of cynical game that the recruiters play into, I believe.
Yeah, it's a lot of people are quite upset about the poverty draft, the disproportionate focus of recruiters on those with the fewest opportunities in life, to the point where, out of a question of fairness and even out of a question of ending wars once 4 million people have died, there are peace activists who want to bring back the draft. And there's a court case happening around getting women on the selective service, and there's a bill in Congress around ending the draft entirely. Where do you think most counter-recruiters come down on the draft question?
Oh, I think most of them are not in favor of a return to the draft, because most the counter-recruiters we've spoken to, and we spoke to over 70 doing the research for this book, they are concerned about militarism and what is the purer form of militarism than to say everyone needs to serve in, or would be liable to a call-up in the case of some national crisis. We didn't ask everyone about this. We had sort of a pre-selected set of questions that we tended to go by when we were talking to these activists, but in looking at what they've written and talking to them more informally, I think most of them would say they're against the draft, and that they would want to have a smaller military footprint in society at large. Now, I hear that there are many people who say, well, you wouldn't have as many wars and kind of imperial aggression if everyone was subject to a draft. So I've heard those arguments, and I think my main issue, my concern with research and activism has been around the recruitment side of things, because that's what we have right now. So
yeah, well, I'm glad you've done it. It's a wonderful book. It is a how-to guide as well as an analysis of what's been happening and what people are doing that I would love to see more people out there doing. It's called Counter-Recruitment and the Campaign to Demilitarize Public Schools. Seth Kirshner, thank you very much for the time and for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, wherever they come down on it, many Americans think of surveillance technology, like facial recognition, as spurring a more or less platonic argument about the relationship between the individual and the state, or corporations. That's a rich enough subject for debate. But in 2016 America, the conversation can suffer from not being grounded in an understanding of how surveillance technology is actually being used right now. Whether we are being watched by private companies or law enforcement and the state, our guest says, not everyone is watched equally. Alvaro Bedoya is the founding executive director of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law. He'll join us to talk about those issues and the color of surveillance. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press. Honduran activist Berta Cáceres was shot and killed in her home in La Esperanza, Intibucá, early Thursday, March 3rd. The killer's ID is unknown, but virtually everyone points to the increasingly reactionary and violent Honduran government, which for years threatened and harassed Cáceres, her family, and her colleagues for their often successful defense of indigenous land rights in the face of corporate attempts at dispossession and extraction. U.S. media noted her murder and the outcry of grief, but as Adam Johnson noted for FAIR.org, coverage had a glaring problem. Almost none of it mentioned that the brutal regime that likely killed Cáceres came to power in a 2009 coup d'état supported by the United States. The Honduran military abducted elected President Manuel Zelaya at gunpoint and flew him out of the country on June 28, 2009. The UN, the EU, and the Organization of American States rushed to condemn the coup, along with 15 House Democrats who sent a letter to the Obama White House insisting that the State Department, quote, follow through with the total suspension of non-humanitarian aid as required by law, close quote. But the State Department, under Hillary Clinton, refused. Emails released last year show that Clinton knew there was a coup, but rather than condemn it, she attempted to use lobbyist Lanny Davis to open up back channels with Roberto Micheletti, the illegitimate interim ruler installed after the coup, an effective endorsement of the new right-wing government. Clinton acknowledges this role in her memoir, saying she planned to push for new elections quickly so as to, quote, render the question of Zelaya moot, close quote. In September 2009, State Department officials blocked the OAS from adopting a resolution that would have refused to recognize Honduran elections carried out under the dictatorship, giving the U.S.'s final seal of approval to the coup that has led to the purging of environmental, LGBT, and indigenous activists. The Washington Post, NBC, CNN, and NPR omitted mention of the coup. The New York Times noted that since the event, journalists, judges, labor leaders, human rights defenders, and environmental activists have been assassinated in targeted killings, with their murders often going unsolved. But the U.S. role in setting that scene was left out. As we tape the show, activists are calling for independent investigation into Cáceres' assassination, as well as protection for Gustavo Castro Soto, coordinator of Friends of the Earth Mexico, who was also shot in the attack that killed Cáceres and is now being interrogated. A March 3rd article in the New York Times carried the headline, Conservative Lawmakers Push New Legal Protections for Opponents of Gay Rights. That headline is echoed in the lead, which reads, quote, less than a year after the Supreme Court recognized a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, conservative lawmakers across the country are pushing for a new round of legal protections for opponents of gay rights, close quote. The story concerns proposed state legislation, usually known as First Amendment Defense Acts. New bills, the reporters say, quote, generally guarantee protection from any penalties for those who, on religious grounds, oppose same-sex marriage, close quote. That language could easily confuse readers into missing the obvious. There are no penalties for opposing same-sex marriage on any grounds. You are free to speak out against it, write articles criticizing it, organize protests denouncing it, and attend religious services condemning it. The full spectrum of First Amendment activities is available to opponents of marriage equality and requires no special defense. What you aren't allowed to do in some situations is discriminate against LGBT people, and these bills are an effort to make it okay to do so. Discrimination has not generally been seen as a First Amendment-protected activity. It's hard to picture the civil rights movement if it had been. But the organized homophobia movement is trying to rebrand discrimination as a kind of speech, hence the marketing of these pro-discrimination bills as First Amendment defense acts. And by framing the story as an attempt to get legal protections for opponents of gay rights, the Times is assisting them in that effort. Critics are quoted saying the bill's intent is to discriminate against gay and transgender people, but the Times never says that in its own voice about bills protecting actions such as refusing to employ openly gay people. The New York Times is often presented as almost immoderately pro-LGBT rights. This sort of story shows why that claim merits a closer look. And finally, March 8th was International Women's Day, but women are anything but international in broadcast and cable news media, as a new study from Media Matters released on that day illustrates. The importance of women's role in armed conflict, where they are especially affected by sexual violence, hunger, and displacement, has been widely noted, as well as women's centrality in the economic and social development that offers alternatives to war. But when corporate media discuss foreign affairs and national security, women all but disappear. Women were just 20% of the guests and commentators on those subjects on primetime cable news, that's CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC, in 2015. The Sunday Important People chat shows on broadcast TV were no better. 23% of their guests on this issue area were women. These are influential conversations about the impact of current and possible military actions, about trade rules affecting local economies, about development plans that change the material circumstances of millions of families around the world. Women's particular place and agency in these realities is a fact. So including women's perspectives in these stories isn't a favor, it's just journalism. Said differently, leaving women out is just discrimination, any day of the year. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Would it bother you if, when you walked into a department store, a hidden camera scanned your face and checked it against a database of VIP customers, suspected shoplifters, and known litigious people? What if your church used facial recognition technology to see who was attending? You can almost divide people between those who find the idea creepy and wrong and those who say, eh, all in a day. With the latter reaction meaning maybe, I have nothing to hide, so what? Or maybe, it's inevitable anyway, that ship has sailed. But is this unprecedented corporate access into our lives permitted just because it's technically possible? What expectations of privacy remain when we shop or walk down the street? How does it relate to government surveillance? And as with government surveillance, shouldn't we ask who, when it comes down to it, is most likely to be harmed? Alvaro Bedoya is the founding executive director of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law. He was chief counsel to the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Alvaro Bedoya.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, I'd like to just beg the question of inevitability and assume that these things are not inevitable. Technology exists, but we decide socially how to employ it. In the case of facial recognition technology, you have been part of the process seeking to figure out how it's used, how privacy is protected. And the way that that process went is worth recounting in some detail because it explains a lot about how we got to where we are. Tell us about those 2015 negotiations. Who was there, first of all?
These negotiations were convened by the Department of Commerce that aimed to have privacy advocates and industry representatives come together and settle upon a set of privacy best practices that companies could basically declare, you know, we're going to adhere to these, and that then could be enforceable against the company for their use of facial recognition technology. They started in 2014, end of 2014, and ran actually to this day, but they broke down in the summer of 2015.
Well, now, you were representing privacy advocates and being a privacy advocate. There were at the table tech companies, advertisers, retailers, and those sort of folks, right?
That's right. Facebook was there. Microsoft was there. The Interactive Advertising Bureau was there. Industry associations like NetChoice were there. And so there are a lot of lobbyists and actual representatives from companies.
Well, the mind-blowing part of this, and folks can find your article about it on Slate.com, but what led to the walkout is these groups really wouldn't even agree to any instance in which consent was necessary. Tell us about what the stumbling block, if you will, was.
Sure. At its most basic level, the right to privacy is the ability to say, no, leave me alone. This is how basically the American legal system has defined the right to privacy with respect to companies since the late 1800s. Right now, when you actually see most companies rolling out facial recognition, as a matter of practice, as a matter of what they do, Janine, they generally don't use it on people to identify them without their permission. And so in this negotiation, the privacy advocates said, well, okay, guys, here's this common sense, actual, in practice, best practice, on the ground best practice, that you have to get permission before using facial recognition to identify someone in general. And so we said, why don't we use that general rule that you have to get permission as a baseline for these best practices? And every single company and industry group that spoke up said no. And so then we narrowed the ask even further. We said, can we all at least agree that when you are walking on a public street, that a company you have never heard of should have to get permission before using facial recognition to identify you by name? And again, not a single company or trade association would agree to that. And that's when we said, you know what? We are arguing with a bunch of, you've heard of yes men, we're arguing with a bunch of no men. We're arguing with a bunch of folks who aren't here to reach an agreement or a consensus. They're here to stop this. And that's when we walked out.
Well, you put your finger on, even more finely, on what's going on here, because you note that, first of all, the policy that they wouldn't agree to on paper is the policy that the companies actually use in practice.
Most of them, that's right.
Because they have customers and customers demand it. And part of what you're identifying as the problem is that the folks who are in that room doing the lobbying, their connection to people, to customers, is rather indirect.
That's right. And this happens at a couple different levels. First of all, the representatives from the companies aren't the folks who are actually, you know, either on the sales floor or rolling out a product online. They are the DC lobbyists. But I want to be honest, frankly, I would have preferred to work with a bunch of actual representatives of companies mm-hmm. with skin in the game. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, they do have brands and reputations to maintain. The deeper layer to this is that you have trade associations that effectively cater to the lowest common denominator of their membership. Let's say, you know, I'm a trade association and there's five companies who are my members. In other words, the folks who pay my bills as a lobbyist. If two of them are okay with heightened privacy standards, but one of them says, no, sir, I gain nothing from those will hurt me, I have to cater to that lowest common denominator. And so the trade associations are entities you've never heard of, I've frankly never heard of until I entered in these negotiations in many cases, and they are putting their foot down and blocking any hope of progress to establish these best practices.
Which is really a fascinating statement about the way the regulatory process and the lobbying decision-making process goes on in this country. It's this tier of industry lobbyists who aren't directly tethered to customers who are, as you put it, shutting down Washington's ability to protect consumer privacy. I mean, it's really quite remarkable and something I would hope that journalists would see has implications even beyond this particular case, obviously, and is worth digging into as just kind of a how laws get made, you know, how policies get made story.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, you also note that there are some things that are kind of structural in the sense that when we talk about government surveillance, we have a couple of places that we can check that. Whether or not we do is another question. But when it comes to private companies, there are kind of fewer tools in the toolbox, aren't there?
Yes. And this is a more subtle point that I think a lot of folks miss. A lot of people look at where we are in terms of government surveillance. You know, they look at the Snowden papers. They look at what the NSA, we now know, has done. And they think, oh, man, you know, we are at a low point in terms of our privacy against the government. But what people forget is that our nation was literally founded on the idea of checking government overreach. And so, you know, we have the Fourth Amendment, which protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures. And we have Congress, where it's very easy to form bipartisan alliances to stop government overreach. You know, Edward Snowden released his documents, The Guardian and The Post published them June 2013. 1 year later, the House had already passed a law to curtail the call records program. 2 years later, the president was signing that law after the Senate had passed it, and a federal judge had declared this program to be unconstitutional. And so, yes, there is government overreach on government surveillance, but we're ready for it. On the other side of the coin, though, as you note, our country was not built to combat corporate overreach. The only world in which a court or a government agency steps in to protect our privacy against companies is a world where either Congress or a state legislature has passed a law allowing them to do that. And unfortunately, as a result of this lobbying, Congress has stopped passing consumer privacy laws. Since 2009, only one minor expansion to consumer privacy law has occurred. And in fact, there's been one other thing, which was a contraction of consumer privacy law. So I'd call it a wash.
Right.
Instead, what you're seeing is state legislatures starting to pass these bills. And that's where I think the hope lies in terms of consumer privacy.
Well, and I'm sure some folks will be saying that Congress could do more and that we could do more on other levels in checking government surveillance. But I think the point is at least we have the structures, at least we have mechanisms to do that. Whereas when it comes to the corporate side, we're kind of grasping to use the tools that we've got. And they're not doing what they might be doing, which is passing new laws. And it's not as though nothing has changed in terms of questions that might be addressed since 2009 in terms of consumer privacy. There's been plenty.
That's right. And look at the technology we're talking about now, facial recognition, geolocation technology, wearables, you know, connected home devices like a smart TV or the Amazon Echo. These are technologies that, you know, around 2008 or so, 2007, 2009, we'd really never heard of. Maybe we heard of geolocation, but all the rest of these were really products of the last 5 or 6 years. And yet all these technologies are effectively unregulated right now.
Well, in a 2014 regulatory finding, you and the center called on Commerce to support strong consumer controls on the collection of personal data. You noted that this kind of ubiquitous collection is not inevitable, but you also pointed out in that finding that a de-emphasis on consumer controls may be particularly harmful for traditionally disadvantaged groups, including the poor, racial and ethnic minorities, immigrants, LGBT individuals, and the elderly. Privacy is in many ways a shield for the weak. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what you mean by that.
Yeah, let's put this in really simple terms. Right now, what a lot of folks in the government and what a lot of companies want is a world where we protect privacy after your personal information is collected. You know, it's kind of like shoot first and ask questions later. Maybe that's unfair, but think about it this way. Traditionally, we've protected privacy by empowering people, particularly in the private sector, to say, yes, I'm okay with you to collect this sensitive information. No, I don't want you to collect that information. And this empowers people to make choices. Now, obviously, as technology becomes more complicated, as we generate almost infinitely larger amounts of data, that exercise becomes harder. But what many in government and what a lot of folks in the private sector are arguing for now is a world where we no longer have that choice, where instead of protecting privacy at the point of collection, privacy is purportedly collected after the fact. And the real problem here is that who is making those decisions about how your information is used? Companies, the government. And for years and years, there is a sad and deep record of companies and the government making very poor decisions about how to treat the information of vulnerable people. The government, for example, during World War II, used census data that was supposedly only going to be used for the census to figure out where Japanese Americans were living, to track them down and detain them in internment camps. Nowadays, you have data brokers who are literally creating lists of individuals who are HIV positive or individuals who are victims of sexual assault or who have diabetes or Parkinson's disease. These are lists that, by and large, aren't going to help the people on those lists.
Right. They're selling those to...
To rip people off. That's right.
So they're selling them to companies. Just to be clear, they're collecting this data and selling it to companies who might then sell things to those people, or...
Data brokers do this, and sometimes they are marketed to other companies that sell them things. Sometimes they're actually literally purchased by fraud rings that call people up and enter them into a series of sweepstakes and other basically fraudulent enterprises that bilk them of thousands upon thousands of dollars. And frankly, we don't know what we don't know about this industry because it is unregulated. And so when I say privacy is a shield for the weak, privacy allows vulnerable people to go about their business and also make choices about their lives without powerful government entities or corporate entities second-guessing them on it and looking over their shoulder and saying, don't do this, do that, or using their data in a way that might harm them.
Well, let's pivot just a little bit. Government and corporate surveillance technology may be subject to different mechanisms, but they share this impulse to collect and to use information that people may not know is being used and whose use can have a serious impact. So there's a reason that your group is hosting a conference in early April that's called The Color of Surveillance. I wonder if you could talk a little about what we ought to know about that aspect of this issue that we're discussing.
Certainly. There is a really interesting thing going on in our country right now. You know, what are people talking about? They're talking about the brutality and pervasiveness of policing in the black community. That is one conversation that's occurring. There is another conversation, though, that's occurring about the role of government surveillance in a free and democratic society. This was triggered by the Edward Snowden revelations, and it continues to this day. And so you have these two huge debates, historic debates, and yet they almost never intersect. There's no discussion of the fact that for almost the entirety of our nation's history, the black community and people of color in general have been the disproportionate targets of unjust surveillance. People might know about Martin Luther King and how the FBI surveilled him. People don't know that the NSA also wiretapped him, and they might not know that it wasn't just Martin Luther King. It was Fannie Lou Hamer. It was Whitney Young of the National Urban League. It was Cesar Chavez. Before that, it was W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey. And before that, enslaved people in our country, in cities like New York, for example, literally could not walk outside after dark without carrying a lantern on them so that everyone could see them. These were called lantern laws. And fast forward all the way to this day, and I realize I'm covering about 300 years of history in about six breaths and four sentences, but today, activists with Black Lives Matter and journalists have revealed that the Department of Homeland Security, an agency founded to combat terrorism, is using its resources to monitor Black Lives Matter, even entirely peaceful activities. And so the purpose of this conference is to bring these communities and bring these conversations together and show that in a world where everyone's watched, everyone is not watched equally. And we need to reckon with that as a society and in Congress.
Writing on this issue, Malkia Cyril noted that many journalists still focus their reporting on the technological trends and not the racial hierarchies that these trends are enforcing. What would you like to see from the press corps? I did notice a piece on the previous issue of facial recognition technology. The Times had a piece on February 29th, and it mentioned harm from companies collecting data, the way they might use a person's health status or financial straits and connect that to unfair or inferior treatment. Certainly, we have seen some coverage of some spying or intervention on organizing. But in general, what would you like to see from media in putting these issues together and carrying the story forward?
Malkia is exactly right, and frankly, she's probably the leader on these issues. What I would like to see is more attention to who the eye is watching. We spend so much time thinking about the eye, how it works, how invasive it is, but we never stop to ask, okay, in what communities are stingrays actually being deployed? And who is in these facial recognition databases? And what communities is predictive policing being rolled out in? And once we start asking the who of these questions and not the how, I think we will recognize that by and large in this nation, invasive surveillance technology is almost as a rule beta tested on low-income Black and Latino communities. That is the first issue. We need to start asking about the who and not the what. The other issue is that we tend to think of surveillance as something technological, and in the 21st century, in 2016, it increasingly is. But we can't forget about all of the run-of-the-mill surveillance techniques, like, for example, stop and frisk, and racial profiling of drivers, and pulling over drivers driving while Black. And we can't forget that stopping someone and searching them on a pretense or for, frankly, no good reason at all, that is surveillance. Stopping someone while they're driving and asking them some questions and seeing if they trip up, that is also surveillance. We can't just think that this is about technology. What it is about monitoring a community. And we need a comprehensive evaluation of this trend, and we need to talk about how to fix it in Congress.
We've been speaking with Alvaro Bedoya of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown Law. His articles, The Color of Surveillance and Why I Walked Out of Facial Recognition Negotiations, can both be found on Slate.com. Alvaro Bedoya, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hey kids, let's go out to the garage and make some new life forms. Get ready, because that's already happening. We'll talk with Pat Mooney, founder of the Etc. Group, about crazy new technology on the loose. Then well-known journalist Stephen Kotler takes us on a tour of eco-psychology in 10 easy steps. Is it a diversion for comfortable people in coffee shops, or is it the answer? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Last week's program on strange record-breaking developments in the Arctic is still waving out into the Twittersphere, still heavily downloaded. You can listen for free at soundcloud.com, Radio EcoShock, or download any of our past programs from our website at ecoshock.org. This week's climate horror story was pretty predictable. Carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere have reached new levels above 404 parts per million. Just 10 years ago, when I started this show in 2006, it was big news when CO2 hit a record high of 381 parts per million. Greenhouse gases are still climbing, and they are increasing faster than ever before. Scientists used to talk about 2 parts per million added every year. Now it's over 3 parts per million for the second year in a row. From February 2015 to February 2016, CO2 levels jumped 3.76 parts per million. The rate of carbon emissions increases are not constant. There is an increase on the increase every year. unless we go into a crash program to save ourselves, catastrophe is right around the corner. Despite the Paris Peace Agreement, government bragging, corporate propaganda, and our own pride when we walk or turn off a light switch, humanity and all the species are hurtling ever faster towards rising seas, an ocean more acid, crop-crushing droughts, and extreme weather. Some plants and animals will not be able to adapt fast enough. They will not survive. Will humans? But climate change is just one face of a revolution in human interference in natural systems. Let's look into synthetic life, a plague of new nanomaterials, and the joys of gene drives. You may be wearing clothes created with synthetic biology and eating food laced with nanotubes. A weird future has arrived without much in the way of warning labels. Our guest Pat Mooney will be your guide. Pat founded a group in 1977 looking into food, agriculture, and commodities. In 2001, it was renamed the Etc. Group, with offices in Canada, the U.S., Mexico, and the Philippines. If it's controversial, the Etc. Group probably has a report on it. Pat Mooney, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's nice to be back. Thank you.
Your latest Etc. Group newsletter has a little humor and a lot of shocking news. I'd like to go through some of it with you. Why don't we start with the scary new industry called synthetic biology? What is that, Pat?
Well, it's sometimes called extreme genetic engineering or genetic engineering on steroids. Rather than moving a gene from one species to another, which is the usual GMO strategy, what this does is allow you to actually modify the DNA of the existing germplasm, whatever it's a plant or an animal or whatever, and make it into whatever you want. So you actually build the DNA. You don't move something from one species to another. You actually say, okay, let's just tweak the DNA as it is, the C, G, T's, and A's that we all learned about in school to make up the double helix, and we'll convert it into whatever qualities, materials that we think would be useful at the end of the day.
And can I truly go out to a store right now and buy something made from synthetic biology?
Yes, you can. You can buy vanilla. If you're in Europe, at least, you can buy vanilla that is a product of synthetic biology rather than being grown in a field in, or in a forest in Madagascar. It's being brewed in a vat in Switzerland. A number of flavor and fragrance commodities, including crops like stevia, the so-called the wonder non-sweetener kind of in soft drinks and so on, is being developed now, is also now being brewed in a vat. Many other commodities may be in the next few years. Cotton, the same way, they're looking into modifying cotton through synthetic biology. Some of the so-called biofuels that are supposed to power our cars and get rid of fossil carbons are also being developed using synthetic biology, though that doesn't seem to be working nearly as well for them.
And now we don't even need a room full of people in white coats to make these new life forms. Your Etc. Group newsletter talks about a company offering, quote, a fully robotic cloud-based biotech lab. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, now what can be done is it's possible to literally go to a field, identify a plant that you might think is useful. You can sample the DNA of that plant on the spot. You can beam it up into a cloud, a big data cloud, where anyone else can download it off the internet and have its full genetic description there, and adapt that then to modify it again through synthetic biology to make it whatever commodity they want to be. So you could find a medicinal plant in the Amazon. You could put it in the internet cloud, and then someone else could use a DNA synthesizer to adjust it to whatever they want to make it.
All right. Now, Pat Mooney, what is going on with labeling of synthetic biology products and also with international efforts to regulate them?
Well, not much. I mean, there is movement, I'm glad to say, but it's been very, very slow. What we've got now is a major concern by some companies. Some of the major flavor and fragrance companies are concerned about this. They're not sure that this product will be well received by customers. A lot of the natural products companies want to ban it all out. Companies like Ben & Jerry's, the ice cream company, have said they won't use synthetic biology in any of their products. And we think several other companies will take the same position. Those discussions are going on right now. But there is, because no one, again, there's no regulation as such. It's being treated as simply a normal product. No one has to sort of do something special to get it approved for use in our food or our crops or our forests or anything else.
Wow. This is the Wild West of genetic playgrounds. So your group has put out an educational video with the Heinrich Böll Foundation about this?
We have, and it's aimed at farmers. It's trying to get them to realize what the implications are if their commodities that they're growing are at risk, that they might disappear the next day, literally, or very soon because of this new challenge. But we're also trying to reach out to the Codex Alimentaire, which is the body in the United Nations organized by the World Health Organization together with the UN Food and Agriculture Organization to deal with how you do monitor and regulate natural products. We're hoping that Codex will come around and say that they don't think that this should be treated as a natural product, that has to involve new regulations and start to work toward that. We're also working with the UN Convention on Biological Diversity, which is based in Montreal in Canada, which is does have now a working group on synthetic biology, which is an intergovernmental working group, but we're part of that group as well. And we're trying to look at, well, what regulations are required. And they're moving fairly quickly on it. There's an alarm at what's being developed. They know that this has real implications for biological diversity and survival. They know it has implications for our food system as well. So they do want to do something. We expect that by the end of this year, there'll be a meeting in Mexico of the Convention on Biological Diversity of all of the member governments, about 195 member governments, that will sit down and try to sort out what regulations are required.
All right. Now, Pat Mooney, before we get back to freaky sci-fi products now on the markets, let's relax a little in the world's forests, except that news is hardly relaxing. Apparently, satellites have been misreading the amount of the Amazon rainforest lost to agriculture. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Well, the satellites were missing large strips of the Amazon. They just weren't hitting that area, and they thought they were covering everything, and they weren't. So they're misjudging how much biological diversity there was and how much biomass there was in the Amazon by about 20-25%. They're not entirely sure how much they misjudged it by. They've also been misjudging the amount of biomass because they're finding that with climate change, the trees are growing faster, but they're not living as long. And so that means, again, that the amount of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere is probably higher than was expected, and the amount that's being stored is probably half of what was expected. And that really changes, again, our understanding of what the forest role is in protecting us from climate change. So that's kind of been a shock to the scientists doing the satellite work and to the rest of us. It's not unusual, I must say, that we've also found that over the years, you'd think with climate change there'd be more and more satellites monitoring the climate. There have actually been less and less in the last several years. They haven't been replacing the ones that have been dropping out of the sky. And the number of instruments on some of the satellites is also less than it was before. So we tend to be, I think The Economist magazine called it willful myopia, deliberately choosing not to know the bad news of what's happening with the climate.
And in other bad news I would never have known without your Etc. Group newsletter, it turns out a huge amount of deforestation is carried out by slaves. I thought slavery was over, and what are they doing with the forests?
Well, they're often the ones that are used, indentured slaves, to do the forest clearing, which is illegal. An awful lot of the forest products that we use, some argue, UNEP, UN Environment Programs argue that it's perhaps as high as 75 to 90% of all forest products, tropical forest products, are illegal. And a lot of that illegal forestry is done, again, by children and adult slaves who have no choice but to do that job. The last study that came out was at the end of last year, at the end of 2015, estimated between 35 and 39 million people are still in slavery around the world.
Let's switch to energy. A few months ago, just before the Paris talks, I broadcast a speech by UK scientist Kevin Anderson. He says there's a big lie built into the IPCC reports and the climate talks. All their plans and scenarios assume any day now we'll deploy carbon capture and storage, known as CSS. And that'll let us carrying on burning fossil fuels. Pat Mooney, what do you say about that?
Well, Kevin Anderson's quite right. He's one of the best scientists in the world on climate change, and he's been dead on over the years as he's done his predictions and projections as to what is going on. what was being said in Paris was a huge lie. It was saying that we can get somehow keep the temperature below 2 degrees or even 1.5 degrees. And even though what governments are pledging to do by their own emission cuts won't get us there, don't worry, folks. We'll take care of that through this idea of carbon capture and storage. We'll suck it out of the atmosphere after it's gone up there, or we'll catch it at the smokestack and bury it in the ground somewhere. Well, that's a nice idea. It sounds cute, but the reality is that technology doesn't exist. Even those supporting the technology don't believe they'll actually make it functional until 2050 or so. That's way too late if we keep on emitting at the way we are, at the rate we are now. But even then, many scientists believe that, frankly, it can't be done at all. The idea that you can take a gas and bury it way down somewhere in the granite of the planet somewhere and keep it there is unlikely. It'll seep back up again. So it's a myth that we can do this, and to suggest that, and this is, of course, what does happen, is that we use the idea of carbon and capture and storage as an excuse for just carrying on with business as usual. Don't worry, folks. We'll take care of it eventually. So carry on driving your SUVs. Everything's going to be fine. Well, it's not going to be fine. We're going to have a temperature rise of 3.3 to 3.6 degrees or perhaps higher by 2100 if we continue as we are now.
And that's a mess. Well, the fallback position for the fossil fuel companies and all of us who want to keep driving cars forever seems to be geoengineering. The international community has managed to stall geoengineering in the real world, except maybe for Russ George, who we talked about a few years ago. How is the dialogue going?
Well, we're losing the battle, I'm afraid. We have a United Nations agreement that geoengineering shouldn't be allowed. That's accepted in the UN. But it's a very soft agreement. It's not, it doesn't have the weight of a police force behind it, so governments can go ahead and do what they want to if they want to, finally. And what we are doing with the Paris kind of decisions is we're getting trapped into a situation where around 2035 or so, we will have actually used all of the carbon dioxide we can possibly put into the atmosphere for this century. And we still have 65 years to go. At that stage, without carbon capture and storage, and we will not have carbon capture and storage, then governments will look around and say, well, we have no choice but to manipulate the planet. We have no choice but to do something called solar radiation management, where we blow sulfates into the stratosphere, a bit like an artificial volcano, and we block just enough of the sunlight to keep the temperature lower, so we can artificially drop it by 2 degrees or 3 degrees if we feel the need to do that. What's very attractive about solar radiation management or geoengineering is that it kind of works. It's pretty cheap. At least the direct costs are pretty cheap, not the indirect costs. And it can be done without the United Nations. It can be done by a single government or a coalition of the willing, maybe of Russia or China or the United States together, saying they'll do it on behalf of everybody else. So they will take control of the planetary thermostat. They'll manipulate the temperature themselves for the rest of us. And that's a pretty scary thought, that they would even contemplate doing that. We're backing ourselves into a corner where that's going to be hard to get out of. We're getting major governments, the German government, the American government, the Russians, the Chinese, the UK, all sort of quietly doing their own studies, issuing their own scientific reports, and they're public, many of them, saying that we have to test this model out. We have to see if we can block sunlight, if we can sort of postpone at least climate change. All of the computer studies that have been done, the simulations by computers of how you'd model solar radiation management, show that it is possible to reduce the damage in the northern temperate zones, depending on how you do it exactly. But if you do that, so you make it a bit safer for us in Canada, the United States, and northern Europe and so on, central Europe even, if you do that, you actually devastate northern South America, sub-Saharan Africa, and possibly, the models vary a bit, possibly South Asia as well. So the majority of the world's population would be disadvantaged, but our part of the world might do a little bit better than it would otherwise.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Pat Mooney. He's the executive director of the Et Cetera Group. We're talking about wild developments in technology. And here's another idea that can't go wrong. Do-it-yourself gene splicing. Pat Mooney, please tell me that's not happening for commercial products.
Oh, yes, it is. Not much is commercial at this stage, but it's a bit of a strange thing. It's like probably looked at 3D printing, the idea that you can sort of print your own fridge gadgets and so on, or, you know, magnets and so on by a little desktop kind of printer that like a normal printer that you have with your computer. It goes back and forth and it builds up black ink and you've got your printed page. Well, you can do the same thing building parts. And now, well, that's been done now for the last several years in terms of building fridge magnets. Now it's possible to actually build DNA. And so we're seeing people buy for perhaps $400. They can go to eBay and get themselves a secondhand gene synthesizer. The synthesizer is about the size of a printer. You put it on your desk. You've got four tubes stuck into it for the A, C, G, and T of DNA. You use your laptop to design the material that you want, and you build it. And you've got yourself perhaps a fluorescent plant, or you've got, which may not live or survive, but you can kind of do it. Or you can put together some unique genetic material that may well live and do something, a microbe or something might be built that way. That's being done now. There are fluorescent plants out there, fluorescent cats as well, I think, for that matter, and rabbits that have been built this way. They don't live, but they are doing it. And it means an individual can do it, not just a company or a quack scientist, but actually just kids playing around can build some of this stuff. We think it's, of course, dangerous. It's 99.9% of the time, or even less, this material will not work. It won't be a threat to anybody. But perhaps 0.001% of the time, they could escape into nature and cause real devastation.
Yes, fluorescent cats take over the world. I'm looking forward to that. Now, in your newsletter, you talk about a technology I'd never heard of, and the initials of it are CRISPR, Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. What the heck is that, and why should we care?
Well, it's an upgrading of what we think of as biotechnology or genetically modified organisms. Again, it's the ability to move a lot of DNA around very simply and easily. The problem with genetically modified crops, for example, is it's very, very expensive. It costs $136 million to develop a new plant variety that's genetically modified. So that's not cheap. With this CRISPR technology, you can perhaps cut that down to a small fraction of that cost, and you can actually make much greater modifications to the DNA of a plant or an animal than you could other, or a human for that matter, than you could otherwise. Attached to the CRISPR technology is something called gene drivers, where you can actually take a trait. Normally, if a plant or humans have a genetic propensity of some kind that doesn't really advantage us as people or the plant, it ceases to exist. It gets wiped out over time because there's no advantage to maintaining that negative genetic trait in your system. But with gene drivers, you can take a negative trait and you can make it a dominant gene so that it really spreads like wildfire throughout mosquitoes, for example, or throughout plants. You can go from being almost nothing to being prevalent in a crop or in a field or in a forest. And that's what's happening with this CRISPR technology together with gene drivers, is that you can take, a pest-resistant plant of some kind, and you can take that trait and you can put it so it's, make it ubiquitous in nature so that everyone's got that same trait in it very, very quickly. You can take a mosquito that gives you malaria, and you can embed in that mosquito a trait that makes it sort of causes it to die quite quickly, or so they can't reproduce, and that can spread throughout all the entire mosquito population of at least that species, which can sound good. It can sound like that's a real benefit to us. You get rid of mosquito and wire that way in theory. But, of course, once you let out a trait like that, which is negative to the species, what if it spreads to other species? What if the mosquito bites something else that then gets that trait? And then we lose that diversity as well. So we just don't know where this technology will finally take us. It's rather than having a pesticide in the field that kills off some pests, you're actually laying that pesticide, jump the fence, run into the forest and cause damage in the forest as well. we're quite worried about what that will do for biological diversity in the planet and how rapidly sort of very negative traits might spread in populations.
Okay. You've just scared the pants off me when I'm thinking about where that could go. Moving on, another buzzword a few years ago was nanotech. How is that coming along?
Well, there's, well, as far as we know, more than 3,000 consumer products in the marketplace today that use nanotech. They range from everything from clothing to tennis rackets to parts of your car and your computer to packaging for food products to pesticides in crop spraying. It's almost everywhere. It's still, again, almost entirely unregulated. Well, that is changing. When we first warned about this in 2001, saying that it could be dangerous, we called for a moratorium on nanotechnology in 2003, and that was ignored. Now we got, even like last week, the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris, the rich countries club, said that this is really dangerous and that there's got to be sort of emergency moves to sort of regulate this because it can be quite dangerous in nature. When you deal with nanoparticles, nanomaterials, you're talking about materials that could be 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter in size, I mean, extraordinarily small, 1/80,000,000th of the width of a human hair, you know, 8 or 10 atoms wide. And material of that size, what's special about it is perhaps two things. One is, of course, your immune system can't even tell it's there. So when you have molecules of this material, it can actually get into your blood system. It can get into your organs. It can cross through the blood-brain barrier. It can pass through the placenta, and your body doesn't know it. So that can be a real threat to us when that happens. The other element that's important in nanotechnology is that the materials, carbon, for example, or graphite, can change in their qualities as you get smaller in size. I've got a wedding ring on that's, I'm told, is made of gold. It's totally benign, very safe. People have gold teeth and so on. They're safe for life. It doesn't cause them any problems. Get down to the nanoscale, and that gold that's so benign can become reactive. It can be chemically reactive. It can actually explode. Its colors change. Its conductivity for electricity changes. Everything about it changes. And at the nanoscale, because the surface area becomes so much greater, in a sense, is exposed to the world, you get these really strange, weird characteristics that we don't know how they're going to perform until they're actually out there being used. Now we have, again, something close to probably 4,000 products in the marketplace, including sunscreens and so on, that I think potentially can be quite dangerous. And finally now, 15 years after the initial warnings went out, we've got government saying, hey, we have a problem here. We better look into it.
And at the bottom of all of what we're talking about here, the Et Cetera Group is working with the United Nations to set up a group to oversee and possibly control technology. I'm pretty pessimistic that we really can. It seems like just what you've been talking about, 3D printing and computers and complex ideas could come out of somebody's basement or the jungle. Can we control technology?
I think we can control the environment around it, and we can do a lot toward that. I'm not putting a lot of faith in the United Nations to do this. The UN has made some moves in the last 12 months or so, which we think are encouraging for that. But what we are creating in that is a forum for debate. The UN has not had any capacity to even talk about technologies, really, in a broad, sweeping kind of way until now. And so at least now governments will get together on an annual basis. They'll do it in June this year in New York and talk about what's going on out there with technologies. What do we need to be watching for? What's on the horizon? Should we be thinking in advance about what has to be done about this? And that, I think, is at least helpful to do. What's more important, perhaps, than just having the UN talk about it is that our partners in civil society, including farmers' organizations, trade unions, unions of concerned scientists, many academic groups as well, are coming together and saying, well, independent of what governments are talking about, what governments are doing, we're going to talk to each other about this. We're going to coordinate together and try to monitor at the national level and the regional level what we know is going on and provide a kind of an early warning system for governments. And what the UN is going to do is provide an early listening system. We're going to provide the early warning system. And we hope that together, at least, we have some capacity to be aware of what's coming down the track. And I think we should be aware that if we look back over the years, civil society has been fairly good at identifying what's coming and how that what's coming could have implications for it, good or bad, for our economy, for our environment, and so on. So I think, you know, there is that capacity there. We just haven't had anyone paying attention to it. So maybe now we'll move towards at least having people pay at least a bit of attention to it.
Well, we're starting to run out of time. We're not going to get to Terminator seeds or blockchain technology. We'll have to leave that to our listeners to Google, or maybe another time we can talk about that. I just want to ask you, back in the 1970s when you started working on issues, did you ever dream you'd experience such a wild tech ride marching into the natural world?
No, no, not at all. No. It took us completely by surprise. We were looking at small things that were happening to seeds, which were small enough in the first place, and concerned about biotechnology, and then we discovered that all these other things that were going on. And again, some of them potentially could be quite encouraging and positive. A lot of them, however, need a lot more thinking, and unless governments are prepared to address them and think about them carefully, what could be a good technology will be a bad technology. And that's really sad, because we need good technology.
Our guest, Pat Mooney, is the executive director of the International Civil Society Organization, the Etc. Group, based in Montreal, Canada, with branches in other countries and co-conspirators all over the world, I'm sure. You can find links to the stories, sources, and reports we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. And please keep up with the latest developments at the website, etcgroup.org. That's etcgroup.org. Pat Mooney, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock, the world's weekly journey into the big future. Browse our previous programs free at our website, ecoshock.org, and you can also find contact information for me there. We know the big problems threatening humanity and the natural world. We even have some affordable solutions. So why do we keep driving on so hard? It seems like towards the cliff of extinction. Maybe it's all in the mind. In this program, we'll add to my short list of interviews on eco-psychology. Stephen Kotler is one of those endangered species called a real journalist. He's been published in the New York Times Magazine, Wired, and much more. His best-selling 2012 book, co-authored with Peter Diamandis, is Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. From New Mexico, Stephen Kotler, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Well, I have to admit, I think the future is much worse than you think, but maybe that's my damaged mindset. So let's talk about the really fine article you published in Orion Magazine, Eco-Psychology in 10 Easy Lessons. First of all, Stephen, why did you go bushwhacking in southern Chile, in Patagonia, in fact?
Well, one of the foundational principles in eco-psychology is that there's a very kind of deep and fundamental connection between the human mind and the natural world. And a lot of people have pointed out that there are psychological consequences that we're not aware of for, you know, the destruction that we're imparting on the natural world. And to get really kind of up close and personal with this, you know, in the midst of so much global warming, fear and noise, not, I don't mean hype at all, but I mean, like, we're hearing it everywhere in every direction. If you care about this earth, it's coming everywhere. You know, if you're going to look at eco-destruction, I wanted to see the melting of the glaciers up close, and I wanted to sort of apply the principles of eco-psychology and kind of get up close to this absolute killing of the natural world and see what it did to my brain.
Well, you know, I had to laugh along with you, Steve, once you were lost in the cold, thinking, hey, eco-psychology is just a diversion for people who are warm at home. Is the conversation about the role of our minds just a pastime for first world folks with time on our hands?
That trip, my interest in eco-psychology, I wrote a book called A Small Furry Prayer about the relationship between humans and animals. And my wife and I co-run an animal sanctuary in northern New Mexico, and A Small Furry Prayer is sort of about our experiences. And the book was very successful. It was a bestseller. It was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. And I went on this giant book tour and 50 cities. And the only people who came to my readings were animal lovers. Nobody, didn't matter how successful the book was, none of that mattered. It was just hardcore animal geeks were the only people showing up. And I started to notice this vast disconnect. It was like I lived in a world where there was nature and there was animals, and I saw these things on a daily basis, but a lot of the people, especially on the other side of my work where I deal with kind of technology and I'm in Silicon Valley and those things, they don't see the natural world. Even if I'm talking about dogs or the work we do here, they're not hearing me, and it's not coming in. So one of the things that I was looking at is what is the difference? Why are some people able to kind of perceive nature and to really see what's going on, and other people are completely oblivious? That's a neurological, psychological issue with, you know, huge political and social and ecological ramifications. So that was sort of what set me off there in the first place.
And I was really interested in how you tied in James Lovelock's Gaia theory and then how that was brought into eco-psychology by the late Paul Shepherd. Can you talk to us about that, Stephen?
So James Lovelock, with Gaia, right, figured out that the Earth is potentially a giant living cybernetic feedback system, right, a sort of a living organism. And what Paul Shepherd, who's just was a brilliant, brilliant mind, brilliant ecologist, kind of realized that if this was true, right, if the Earth actually is a giant cybernetic feedback organism, and you can argue Gaia in all different directions, but there are certainly, you know, there's certainly a lot of interesting proof in the direction that it's a legit theory at this point. And Shepherd said, hey, if this is legit, then if we're one giant living organism, then there are direct connections between the natural world and the human mind. And the great, and this isn't his, James Serpel also kind of poked at this idea. A lot of people have poked at it, but what Paul Shepherd kind of pointed out is that, for example, we didn't grow up thinking of animals as other. We actually grew up thinking in animals. They were our first metaphor. They're still the metaphor we reach for. He's as hungry as a wolf. The terminology goes on and on. But he literally, his argument is we learn to think in animals. We learn to think in nature. It was our first kind of comparisons, our first grounds for comparisons. It's how we learn to navigate the natural world. And these sort of deep structures, to use Claude Lévi-Strauss's word, are sort of embedded in our brain. So his argument is that we are experiencing kind of the death of the natural world at a really deep fundamental level that goes in so far and so primal and so kind of baked into our evolution that we don't notice the massive damage it's doing.
Well, this idea that damage to nature is also damaging our own mental health is gaining more ground. There was a U.S. National Wildlife Federation report on it in 2012 with experts, and I just saw an article about it in a major Canadian newspaper February 28th.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the eco-psychology, it's not a new field. It's been around for 30, 40 years at this point. I'm thinking Theodore Roszak coined the term, I think, in the 70s, maybe in the 80s. But so the ideas have been around. They've been percolating a while. And, you know, there is all kinds of very, very, very real science, both on the cause, like we understand some of the neurobiology of what we're talking about here, as well as the effect side. So for sure, I mean, eco-psychology is why they have found that a 20-minute walk in the woods outperforms all the ADHD medicines on the market. We have a deep psychological relationship to nature, and if you want to calm down the brain, walking in natural spaces is more effective than the best drugs we have. And there's study after study after study showing this.
That's true. I read about that. That's very true. Okay, now, you also mentioned Laura Seawall and her essay, The Skill of Ecological Perception. I'm not familiar with that one. How does that tie into what you were working on?
Essentially, what you're talking about when you're talking about eco-psychology is awareness. And I'm going to talk about this from a neurobiological angle. So every second of every day, your senses take in a massive, massive, massive amount of information. It's been calculated somewhere between, and this is a ridiculous range, 11 million bits a second and 400 billion bits a second. Whatever it is way, way too much for the conscious mind to process. The extreme outer limit of what we can process consciously, what our working memory can hold on to at once, is essentially 2,000 bits. And it, like most of us really can only hold on to about 120 bits at once. And to put that in context, you're listening to me talk. That is taking up 60 bits of RAM in your brain. So there's only about two people talking, and that's it. So you've got this massive amount of information coming in and a very, very reduced consciousness, very few bits of information. Now, most of your consciousness, because of how the brain is wired up and how information filters through the brain, is filled with stuff that we could possibly be afraid of for obvious evolutionary reasons. We want to survive, so we pay a lot of attention to those things that scare us. It's some significant portion of our consciousness. I've heard numbers all over the place. 70% of the stuff that gets in is one thing that I hear fairly often. It's basically stuff that we might, that we could be afraid of. If you're talking about 2,000 bits coming in a second and 60-70% is taken up by stuff that could kill us or we're worried that could kill us, very little other information is coming through. If you don't care about the natural world, if that's not interesting to you, if you're not noticing, you literally, it will be invisible to you. And this is something, you know, we're talking about this very, very theoretically, but I spend a lot of time in Silicon Valley, a lot of time around a lot of technologists who are taking on grand global challenges, poverty, hunger, water, really significant issues, and yet they live in a world that's very technological. They sit in front of screens all day long. They very rarely get into the natural world, and they don't even see nature. So the very people, I believe, and this is sort of what we write about in Abundance a little bit, who are best suited to address some of the challenges that we're facing, they don't even see the fact that there are challenges out there because they don't see nature, because they haven't tuned their brain to appreciate it at all, so it can't come in. What Laura Sewall has done, to return back to your original question, is she has sort of broken our, what I'm terming appreciation nation. What I literally mean is the ability to see the natural world. She's come up with a five-step process with which somebody can kind of learn to see the natural world. It was a process I was playing with when I was down in Patagonia. And, you know, the funny thing about the process, as I pointed out in the article, I went down to Patagonia, and it was already an arduous trip to kind of the end of the earth, but, you know, the storm of the century blew in. We had 100-mile-an-hour winds. As you read in the article, I got blown off the side of like a 30-foot waterfall and landed in shrubbery because the wind was so fierce. And, you know, it's kind of funny when you're trying to, like, deploy these five steps towards ecological perception, you know, so you can see the natural world at a very point that, like, the natural world is doing nothing but kicking your butt.
Well, you know, if human intelligence was developed over a very long time as hunter-gatherers, is it really any wonder we've become so crazy living in these concrete boxes looking at screens where nature's more or less banned, just as you said?
Yeah, there's certainly no way around it. Everything we know about evolution teaches us that these things are going to be encoded pretty, pretty deep, and to deny ourselves access to it is just, it's significant. And, you know, there's massive mental health concerns. We know being out in the natural world is something that lifts depression. Same reasons, right? Like, we're wired this way. We need that contact. I'll give you a crazy, totally separate thing that nobody actually in the world knows exists, but I run a dog sanctuary, and part of our healing methodology is to create an environment, because we work with very, very sick animals, is to create an environment using evolutionary psychology that's very, very similar to an environment that dogs evolved in. So dogs evolved in small groups of humans, big groups of dogs, and they all den together, right? Like, we slept with dogs. That was one of the reasons we cohabitated with them. The phrase three-dog night is literally a night so cold that you need three dogs in the bed to survive, right? It's even coded into our language. So here's something that interesting. This is eco-psychology in action. Dogs have better senses of hearing and better senses of smell than humans. So when you cohabitate with dogs, and this is what we evolved to do, so everybody's hardwired to do what I'm about to explain. What happens is, after a little while of kind of sharing your bed with a bunch of dogs, this big pack, is you start outsourcing safety and security. So you have a hyper-vigilant response in your brain every second. It's kind of screening for danger, right? But dogs smell better. They hear better. They're better danger detectors. So the process naturally, just by cohabitating with dogs, gets outsourced. So when I go, I do a lot of public speaking, I do a lot of traveling, I'm on the road. The second day I'm in a motel, my body will start to realize I'm not surrounded by dogs, and my vigilance centers will turn back on. And for that entire the second night I'm in a hotel, I won't sleep because every sound wakes me up, because I'm not hardwired to actually deal with it. I co-evolved with dogs. I'm hardwired to outsource that to them and let them deal with it. And when that goes away, raises my stress response. I lose sleep.
Do you find yourself longing for the apocalypse? I did. I was looking for a reason to live. Hi. Are you feeling tired, irritable, stressed out? Well, you might consider nature.
From the people that brought you Getting Outside comes prescription-strength Nature. a non-harmful medication shown to relieve the crippling symptoms of modern life.
Nature's recommended for humans of all ages, and it's great for pets, too.
Nature can reduce cynicism, meaninglessness, anal retentiveness, and murderous rage. In clinical studies, nature is proven to decrease work-induced catatonia.
Caution. Nature may cause you to slow down, quit your job, or seriously consider what the f*** you're doing with your life.
If you are overly cynical, jaded, or emotionally numb, you may need to increase your dose.
Do you find yourself longing for the apocalypse? I did. I was looking for a reason to live. Hi. Are you feeling tired, irritable, stressed out? Well, you might consider nature.
From the people that brought you Getting Outside comes prescription strength Nature, a non-harmful medication shown to relieve the crippling symptoms of modern life.
Nature's recommended for humans of all ages, and it's great for pets, too.
Nature can reduce cynicism, meaninglessness, anal retentiveness, and murderous rage. In clinical studies, nature is proven to decrease work-induced catatonia.
Caution. Nature may cause you to slow down, quit your job, or seriously consider what the f*** you're doing with your life.
If you are overly cynical, jaded, or emotionally numb, you may need to increase your dose of nature. Do you have trouble being even mildly uncomfortable? Nature may not be right for you. Side effects may include spontaneous euphoria, taking yourself less seriously, and being in a good mood for no apparent reason.
So ask your doctor if nature is right for you.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, talking with the best-selling author and journalist Stephen Kotler about the prizes and the perils of eco-psychology and many other things. If you'll give me a second, Steve, I'd like to read a short quote from your article, Eco-Psychology in 10 Easy Lessons. After looking at the meltdown of the glacier, you were saying, once this meltdown is complete, it will not reverse. The freshly melted water will never become ice again, at least not in any time frame that is fathomable in human terms. What does it feel like to witness these end times, awful, like murder, like I'm the one who is melting? So I'm wondering if we can really, Stephen, stand the pain of recognizing ourselves in this eco-psychological mirror.
It's an interesting question. I think about this a lot because I think anybody with any kind of environmental awareness these days, you sort of have to function at all in this world, numb a huge portion of yourself, ignore a huge portion of kind of what's going on around you at all times, which, you know, I'm no expert, but I can't think it's healthy.
Yeah. You know, I've had guests who've compared our behavior in these times to the mass murders of the Holocaust in World War II. Do you think that's going too far?
You know, I think that's a very hot, touchy subject, but what, I mean, we've got species die-off rates that are 1,000 times greater than normal. It's the sixth great extinction. You're comparing that to a Holocaust, right? An attempt to murder a people. But if you're, you know, I'm going to get killed for this, but if you're working the numbers, I mean, we're talking about whole species, many species, going extinct forever every year. So, you know, I know people care more about people than they do plants and animals, and they those kinds of comparisons make them very, very upset. But I always look at this question kind of neurobiologically. For a really long time, nobody kind of wanted, you know, dogs were research animals. And dogs are essentially, from an intelligence perspective, from an emotional perspective, they have the same six core emotions we do, the same social emotions we do. They're essentially four-year-old children in their IQ and vocabulary. And, you know, we do things to dogs that we would never do to four-year-old children. So people don't like it when you make those comparisons between, say, you know, the sixth great extinction and the Holocaust. But I don't think you're that far off.
Well, given all we've talked about, what gives you the optimism about the future found in your best-selling book, Abundance?
Well, so you have to understand that what is at the core of abundance is this idea that right now, for the first time in history, because of four emerging forces, we have the possibility to significantly raise global standards of living and address many of our grand challenges. And the difficulty here is it's a race against time, right? We're either going to drive ourselves into a world of abundance or we're going to wipe ourselves off the face of the earth. And we're not saying this is techno-utopianism. Our argument is not that this stuff happens automatically. It's that it is actually possible. We know how to... even the sixth great extinction, like, this is no mystery. We've known since the 60s, essentially, how to stop the sixth great extinction. You take a bunch of land away from people and you give it back to the plants and animals. You link up our national parks with migration corridors and you stay out of the way. You give animals more space and more room to roam. We've known that since, you know, Michael Soule did his island biogeography work back in the 60s and 70s. It's not a mystery, right? We now have the technology that liberates that land. For example, cattle occupy one quarter of all the land on the earth. We have in vitro meat. We can grow steak from stem cells. You know, painless beef grown from stem cells in bioreactors frees up a quarter of the land on the planet. We can repurpose that land for animals. It's not hard, and people are doing it. In fact, the U.S. military has been doing this, you know, for 80 years. They've been setting up eco barriers and migration corridors, and, you know, they found it the most successful thing they could do to kind of fight off lawsuits from environmentalists, and it works. It brings species back. We've seen it. We've got the proof. We know how to solve this, and we have the technology, and that's just one example. I could talk about vertical farms. I could go on and on about this stuff, but we have the technology to solve these problems. Are we going to do it is an open question. And but what we are saying in abundance is, hey, wait a minute, this is actually now possible today. And we're also saying that a lot of the bad news you believe in is actually wrong. You have wrong information. And I'll just give you a couple of examples since we go in this direction. One of the things that's really, really tricky is that, take poverty, for example. It's something of a moving target. If you go back 100 years ago, the richest people on the planet did not have air conditioning, a cell phone, a television, air conditioning, a car, flushing toilets, running water for that matter. Today, people living below the poverty line, 70% of people below the poverty line have access to all those things. So we keep moving the number, but if you go by, you know, current studies at current rates of decline, by current definitions of poverty, you know, and this is studies run in The Economist by top thinkers, we're going to end poverty by our current definition in 30 years. Or if you go, you know, you want to go back in time, poverty has been reduced more in the past 50 years than any point in the previous 500. According to Steven Pinker, we are living at the most peaceful time in the history of the human race. Any groceries are 13 times cheaper today than they were in the 1800s. The list goes kind of on and on about what's kind of going on. So there's actually a ton of really great news that we don't tend to look at. And by the way, the reason we don't look at it is because our brain is dominated by looking for danger. So we notice the negative much more than the positive. And that's like, you know, established psychological and neurobiological fact. Basically, for every kind of one positive thing that gets into your brain, you'll notice 10 negative things.
That's so cool what you just said. You know, I've had this argument too with Brian Welch. He's the CEO of the company that publishes Mother Earth News, and he wrote a book, Beautiful and Abundant, Building the World We Want. And he got me thinking, is it possible that we have so much trouble partly because we lack a vision of who we want to be?
Oh, I think you hit it on the nail. I mean, I really, like, we go where we look. And what I mean that is, like, we are literally hardwired biologically to go where we look. And this is a weird example. Do you surf by any chance?
I did when I was younger.
Okay. Have you ever ridden a tube?
I never really got that good.
Okay. One of the things that happens when you're tube riding is when you pull into the wave, you make your bottom turn, and all you do is you look through the tube, because everything is happening at so high speed. So how do you surf a tube? You literally look through the tube, and your body goes where you look. Everything else sort of happens automatically. That's not just a surfing athletic phenomenon. That is how we are wired to work. I'll give you another crazy example, and this comes out of, I run the Flow Genome Project. We study ultimate human performance. So this is stuff that comes out of the other side of the work I do and studies of ultimate human performance. But in ultimate human performance, there's something called the Bannister effect, and it's really peculiar. So Roger Bannister, as you probably know, is the first guy to run the 4-minute mile. And before he did it, everybody thought it was impossible. There were New York Times op-eds written by doctors saying, look, the first person who runs a 4-minute mile is going to die at the finish line. Forget a parade. You're going to need a hearse. And it took forever to do it. I mean, if you look at mile times, they went down by like a half a second, a fraction of a second, a decade, for like 60 years. And then Bannister does it, And the next month, somebody beats his time. And a couple months after that, somebody else beats his time. And within 10 years, a teenager has beat his time. So what the hell? Right? The physical challenge running a four-minute mile did not change. It's still a sub-4 mile. It's really physically difficult. All that changed is the mental frame we build around the challenge. This is called the Bannister effect, and what it means is there's a very, very tight correlation between psychology and performance. You have to believe something is possible before it's possible. And there are, for all the reasons we've been talking about, kind of how the brain filters information, for all the reasons that you might imagine, this is very, very true. So one of the things, you know, I often have said is if we want to solve a lot of problems, we could just start by getting the technologists and the environmentalists and the ecologists in the same room together so they see each other and hear each other and have to talk to each other. I really do believe, you know, the solutions are within our reach. But I'll give you an interesting example. In abundance, for example, one of the things that we talk about is if you want to solve the biodiversity crisis, coupling in vitro meat to vertical farms, two technologies that massively liberate land and repurposing this land for animals and plants. It's the center of the book. We talk about it in the book, and yet the book came out, it was a massive bestseller, and in the hundreds of interviews and talks and speeches and whatever I've done about the book, nobody's ever asked me about that because nobody sees nature. They see all the other stuff we wrote about feeding people and getting people water and providing freedom and health care and education, all the people-centered stuff, but the animal stuff is still a giant mystery to people. So I think the solutions are there, and it's really important to know that they're there because we're hardwired to go where we look.
Well, just as we wrap up, what is the Flow Genome Project?
We are the largest kind of open source research project in ultimate human performance. We want to decode the science of ultimate human performance, and it's called the Flow Genome Project because flow is a technical term, scientific term, for a state of optimal performance. It's a state where we feel our best and we perform our best. And more specifically, it refers to those moments, I'm sure you've experienced them yourself, of rapt attention, total absorption. You get so focused on what you're doing, everything else just vanishes. So action, awareness start to merge, time dilates, which is a fancy way of saying you don't notice that it's passing. 5 hours will go by in like 5 minutes. Your sense of self sort of disappears, self-consciousness, that voice in your head, that incessant chatter goes quiet. And performance, all aspects, go through the roof. And flow science sort of dates back about 150 years, but over the past 20 years, there's been a revolution in neurobiology. We've been able to look under the hood for the very first time, see where this state is coming from, see how it shows up, how we can get more of it. And so the Flow Genome Project is an organization of people who are dedicated to kind of decoding the science of flow, and we're training people up in it. So we're a research and a training organization, and on the training side, we work with everybody from kind of top athletes to the U.S. Special Forces to Fortune 500 companies, and we train people up in how to maximize flow and productivity and motivation and those sorts of things.
Is there anything that I've missed that you'd like to pass on to our listeners or a new project you want to tell us about?
The only thing I want to pass along is if this stuff is interesting to you, you can find me online at stephencotler.com or at theflowgenomeproject.com or on Twitter at Stephen_Kotler, which is K-O-T-L-E-R.
Well, we based this interview on Ecopsychology and 10 Easy Lessons in Orion Magazine, and I'll put a link to that on my blog at ecoshock.info. You may also be interested in Stephen Kotler's book, Tomorrowland, Our Journey from Science Fiction to Science Fact. That sounds good to me. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Ecoshock.
Alex, my pleasure. Thank you.
Radio Ecoshock reaches out to you every week from over 90 nonprofit radio stations in 4 countries and countless net stations. If you agree this program content is important, you can help, please go ahead and forward the show widely. Tweet about it. Get it on Facebook. Play it for your friends. Thank you for helping me get the word out by extending the voice of our expert guests.
Are you suffering from an existential crisis? Prescription Strength Nature may help you. Clinical studies have shown that nature can save you from your neutered existence.
Being in nature can remind you that you have a body and that you're not the center of the universe.
If you care more about selfies than preserving the natural beauty and wonder of the environment, you may need to increase your dose of nature.
Our fake ad for Nature, as the new pharmaceutical wonder drug, was created by the folks at nature-rx.org. You can find the video version on YouTube with the link in my show blog at ecoshock.info. We'll finish up with a tune by Natalie Merchant. It's called It's a Comin'. I first saw this posted on Guy McPherson's blog, Nature Bats Last. Here are Natalie's opening words. Wildfires, dying lakes, landslides, hurricanes, apocalypse in store, nothing like ever seen before, it's a comin'. Third-generation refugees, street mobs, burning effigies, revolution, civil war, like nothing ever seen before, it's a comin'.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Electronic Intifada.
Intifada
Electronic.
The Electronic Intifada.
El Electronica.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. In a few minutes, we'll go to Virginia, where Palestine solidarity activists were able to pressure lawmakers to table an anti-boycott bill in the state Senate. But first, we go to Hebron in the occupied West Bank. On February 26th, Palestinians participated in a demonstration to commemorate the 22nd anniversary of the 1994 massacre at the Ibrahimi Mosque. The protesters also called for the lifting of recent Israeli military orders restricting freedom of movement placed on the Palestinian residents of areas of the Old City, where the mosque is located. During the protest, Israeli forces fired stun grenades and massive amounts of tear gas onto the crowd in what activists with the International Solidarity Movement called a, quote, ambush. During the peaceful demonstration, Israeli occupation forces assaulted and arrested Farid al-Atrash, a prominent human rights lawyer with the Independent Commission for Human Rights. Deman News Agency reported that the organization called the violence used against al-Atrash a crime. Al-Atrash was released from Israeli detention on March 1st. Activists with the local organization Youth Against Settlements helped organize the demonstration as part of their ongoing campaign to open the area of the Old City that has been sealed off to Palestinians and taken over by Israeli settlers who are often violent with impunity and under protection from the Israeli military. Isa Amro, an organizer with Youth Against Settlements who is joining us from the Old City of Hebron, was himself arrested earlier this week by Israeli forces and reportedly accused of incitement against Israel for his political activities. Isa, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast. We're so glad you're out of Israeli jail and able to join us again. Can you talk about the protests last week and the violence in response by Israeli forces?
We are organizing an ongoing campaign calling to reopen the closed streets, the closed markets, the closed shops in the old city of Hebron. We are asking for equality, for justice, for self-determination for the Palestinian people, and to end the occupation, to end the illegal Israeli settlements and dismantle them from our own cities. So this year we organized a big campaign all over the world. It was in Germany, in Italy, in France, in Europe, all over Europe, in the U.S., the Israeli occupation forces didn't like our peaceful protests. And in the beginning of the campaign, they attacked us. They prevented us from holding a nonviolence painting action outside one of the checkpoints. They prevented us from painting at the checkpoint. Then they tore down Hadil al-Hashlamun Memorial. Hadil was killed by the Israeli occupation forces, and her killing was described by Amnesty International as an extrajudicial execution, but the Israeli soldiers, they just stole it during the night and destroyed that memorial. On the 22nd and the 26th, the Israeli soldiers attacked our peaceful protest. They used violence, and for the first time, they aimed on me to shoot me by a direct order from one of the commanders. They were very violent. They violently arrested Farid al-Atrash, who is well known as one of the best human rights defenders in Palestine, and working for peace and justice, and increasing the awareness about the human rights violation. So the soldiers prevented us from continuing our protest toward the Ibrahimi Mosque, where the massacre happened, and near Shuhada Street, which was closed by the Israeli occupation forces after the Ibrahimi Mosque massacre.
And Isa, you were arrested a few days after the protest as well. Can you tell us what happened and this claim of incitement that the military charged you with, what that means?
Unfortunately, the Israeli occupation forces, they don't want anyone to speak loud against the occupation, against the apartheid, against the discrimination. My arrest was kind of intimidation, kind of threatening me to go away from Tel Rameda and the old city and stop my nonviolence activities and my human rights work. On the 29th of February, Israeli soldiers reached me when I was talking to Breaking the Silence delegation. They were prevented from coming to my house, so I started talking to them outside my house on the yards. Then Israeli soldiers came and arrested me, and they accused me of incitement against the occupation and organizing violent protests, which was not true. I denied all that accusation. I have a lot of evidences about my nonviolence work and everything we do, and mainly they were investigating me about Open Shuhuda Street campaign and about the activities, about my Facebook account, about me writing to my people to disobey the soldiers, orders to to go around their normal roads to protect the Palestinian houses from the Israeli settlers, you know, talking to the media. They used it as kind of incitement, so they don't want me to talk against the occupation at all. I was ill-treated. I was arrested. The Israeli media, the fanatic and the right-wing media announced that they arrested me because of my violent protests and incitement, which was not true at all, and I was released, and I'm waiting the trial. They to tell me when is the trial on the next days.
Issa, can you talk a little bit more about the treatment that you faced while being detained and jailed by the Israeli military?
It is very long investigation without any kind of respect. I am under the Israeli military law, which means that I am guilty and I need to prove the opposite of what they say. They don't need to prove what they say. This is something very, very important, and we should, address it. Handcuffed and blindfolded, I was left 5 hours outside the police station with a very cold weather inside the military detention center, very dirty, environment, no good food, very bad food. We were around 10 people in six meters square, very small cell, very bad treatment from the soldiers at the detention center. You don't have any right. You don't call your family. You don't talk to anyone. You don't talk to your lawyer. You don't know where are you exactly as a Palestinian staying in a cell with other Palestinians. You had nothing to read or to make yourself busy. So it was really hard experience.
We're speaking with Issa Amro. He is an organizer with Youth Against Settlements and speaking to us from his home in the old city of the occupied West Bank city of Hebron. Issa, last time we spoke, the military orders were still in place, restricting freedom of movement for you, your family, your neighbors, activists and journalists who want to visit, even emergency medical workers. You mentioned Amnesty International. That organization also released a public statement last week urging Israel to, quote, lift the discriminatory restrictions and the collective punishment of Palestinians in the city and protect human rights defenders there. Have those orders been renewed? And how does this continue to affect your daily life in the old city?
Unfortunately, we are living in the old city with very restrict life. 20 checkpoints, more than 100 movement obstacles, soldiers, settlers, everything was closed before even November. But unfortunately, on November, they declared the area as a closed military zone, which means that you don't have any basic rights. And they made it very hard for the people to stay, to visit, and the ambulances. And so it became as you are in jail without any protection and any food. These days, we don't know what is happening. They didn't tell us if it's renewed or not. And they renew it whenever they want. They do whatever they want. They are just preventing people to come in without any kind of orders. We hope that that they can, stop working with the closed military zone and to end the occupation. As Palestinians, we see that there is kind of ethnic cleansing and it's kind of targeting our Palestinian identity in the old city of Hebron.
Well, finally, Issa, how has Youth Against Settlements been able to keep organizing under these kinds of restrictions? And what are your plans for the immediate future?
Unfortunately, we were affected by these restrictions and our center is closed. We don't have any kind of training for our youth. We don't have any kind of education for the Palestinian women, girls, boys about nonviolence and how to go on with our documentation project. We were documenting all the human rights violations. Now we are not able to continue and to do that because of the closed military zone orders and because of the direct targeting of the Israeli occupation forces and the settlers to our activists and to our volunteers. we are trying to have an alternative center, but it's not the same. It's very hard to continue in this kind of circumstances. As a human rights defender, you are thinking about your own protection. You are thinking about how to defend your life, and you are not able to defend other people's rights or to document what is happening around you. And it's kind of a phenomenon that human rights defenders became a target to silence them and not to make them speak loud against human rights violations and against the occupation and illegal settlements.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. That's the voice of Isa Amro. He is a coordinator with Youth Against Settlements in Hebron, and you can find them on Twitter at YAS Hebron. Isa Amro, we're so glad that that you're out of Israeli detention and that you're continuing to organize. Thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast, and we'll keep checking in with you about the situation in Hebron.
Okay, thank you very much.
Up next, we speak to activists in Virginia who organized to successfully table a bill in the state Senate that would have suppressed boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns across the state. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Visit us online at electronicintifada.net or follow us on Twitter at Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Intifada Electronic.
Intifada Electronic.
The Electronic Intifada.
In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. In late February, U.S. President Barack Obama signed a trade bill into law intending to shield Israel from the Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign under the guise of protecting competitive trade. The bill is part of a growing wave of anti-BDS legislation introduced into nearly two dozen states and at the federal level by pro-Israel lawmakers and backed by Israel lobby groups as well as the Israeli government itself. However, BDS activists, Palestine solidarity organizers, and legal experts are fighting against the efforts at repressing boycotts, which are constitutionally protected under the rights of free speech. In Virginia, activists from a broad-based coalition were able to rally thousands of citizens against the passing of a bill that would have required the state to compile information on the BDS movement and could have led to a McCarthyist blacklist of companies who don't do business with Israel. In a press release, activists with the Freedom to Boycott in Virginia coalition say that, quote, delegates heard from thousands of Virginians who are fed up with the status quo of unconditional U.S. support for Israel and its violations of Palestinian rights, and support BDS as a peaceful tool for Palestinians seeking their freedom. That opposition grew when the bill came to the Senate, resulting in the unanimous committee vote to drop consideration in this legislative session. Joining us to talk about the decision by the Virginia State Senate to table the anti-boycott bill are two activists with the Freedom to Boycott in Virginia Coalition, Seth Morrison and Saba Shami. Seth and Saba, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. We're delighted to be with you.
So as I said, anti-boycott legislation is hitting or has already hit nearly two dozen states across the country in a concerted effort to clamp down on Palestine solidarity organizing and constitutionally protected free speech rights. Can you talk about this bill that was before the state legislature, what it would have required the state to do, and the significance of it being tabled based on popular pressure against the bill? Saba, do you want to start?
Sure. I believe that there was a concerted effort to first introduce the resolution, which was probably intended to soften the delegates and the senators to then, you know, accept as a follow-up kind of to the resolution, the bill that would have been quite disturbing to many in Virginia, especially people who view the right to free speech as being a holy foundation of our democracy here. So both Seth and I, coming from two different religious ethnic backgrounds, I'm Palestinian Christian and he's Jewish American, I decided that we needed to do something about it here. And with the help of some friends from the neighboring state of Maryland, we put together a a nice coalition, which then developed into mainly or almost exclusively Virginia-based group of people. And then we assembled a nice coalition of, correct me with the number, Seth, I believe the last count was 12 groups, right?
Correct.
And so the bill, the first, let me tell you about the resolution 177. It was the House joint resolution, which they wanted to take to the Senate, which we are expecting it to be discussed tomorrow in the Rules Committee of the Senate, was filled with inaccuracies and straight out lies about what is the BDS and what is the intent of all these fine Americans of all backgrounds, from you know, non-Arab, non-Jewish, to Jewish, to Arab, to Muslim, to Christian, to people with no faith, people who are agnostic, just we, you know, the average Americans who felt that muzzling people's right to speak up about issues of importance to them was very unconstitutional. And so we really worked very hard to block that. Unfortunately, we are, and this is what, one of the amazing things about the other side, meaning the pro-Israeli government, and I'm not saying pro-Israel, I'm saying pro-Israeli government, because we really cannot just take and lump all the Israeli people as being in cahoots with the policies and the atrocities, both physical and you know, political atrocities of the Israeli government. So we felt here that the game that they played was very sneaky. They, one day we hear from some of our friends that this thing is creeping down to Richmond and they're trying to pass another one. Unfortunately, we could not stop it, but we were delighted in the General Assembly, in the House of Delegates, to get, my last count was we had 13 no's and abstentions and no votes, which is a big deal in terms of last-minute kind of activism and attempt to stop something that most legislators are not even familiar with. And that's where I consider it to be unfair kind of situation. But, you know, in politics, there's nothing fair. So the bill, which is House Bill HB 1282, was more dangerous. The first one was toothless, basically, and I've classified these bills that are gone taking place all over the country as I Love Israel bills, and it became a term here in Virginia, used even by some of the legislators. The bill is clearly a more dangerous one because it was supposed to impose penalties on companies and individuals in Virginia who do more than $10,000 worth of business with the state, if you know, they are found. It reminds you of the pogroms in Russia and the Spanish Inquisition. You know, if you're found in violation of I Love Israel kind of rules, therefore you are in violation of this state law, that which means you cannot do business with the state, and potentially they could have developed it to impose penalties, financial penalties. So luckily we were able to keep it, the committee that was entrusted with it, General Rules and Technology, General Laws and Technology, actually tabled it till next year. Which means that it will probably be left out there in the cold to die.
Well, yeah, it's true that 1282 was definitely watered down in the House because they realized that it was unconstitutional. But I think what's really significant is that we pulled together, you know, 12 organizations, And for the first time, the legislators heard opposition to what Saba rightly called I Love Israel bills and resolutions. And I think a lot of them were taken by surprise. You know, there's so much ignorance out there, and so many people just believe the propaganda that, you know, Israel is our greatest ally, Israel is the only democracy. And suddenly the politicians started hearing from thousands of constituents, from voters, who said, wait a minute, we have a problem here. You know, Israel is not treating the Palestinians well. And I think that's really making a difference.
Can you talk a little bit more about the specific strategies your coalition employed to organize and pressure the state Senate lawmakers to table this bill, perhaps indefinitely?
Well, we, first of all, did a number of action alerts that we did in cooperation with our friends at the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, because they have, you know, very targeted software. We also encouraged our members and leaders to make personal phone calls. And we're very lucky to have some dedicated supporters in Richmond who went to committee hearings and went office to office in the legislature distributing our fact sheets. And then we organized a couple of trips for small groups of us to go down to Richmond to meet with our legislators.
Saba, there are so many other Palestine Solidarity coalitions and organizations who are trying to fight similar legislation in their own states and counties, and also at the federal level. What can these other coalitions learn from your strategic organizing? What kinds of advice do you have for them?
I would say that it is crucial to involve any and all groups who are and individuals who are willing to help. You don't need to agree with them 100% on all issues, but when it comes to this issue of muzzling and limiting the freedom to free speech, the right to free speech here in America, in each and every state, in every locale, if you find partners and coalition potential coalition members who are agreeing to that minimum of support for your right, then you should pursue it. We in Virginia, to be frank with you, relied on two formidable constituencies: the Arab American community, which is very strong in Virginia compared with other places. I never did statistics about Arab American concentrations, but here in Northern Virginia, we have in the neighborhood of 150,000 Arab Americans, which is a large community. So in that mass, you can find a few hundred people who were willing and actually did write letters and participated in our efforts. The second group, and not second in terms of importance, are Jewish Voices for Peace. This is a group that is clearly growing in numbers and influence. And, you know, myself as the leader of the New Dominion PAC here in Virginia, and Seth clearly the leader in the area here of Jewish Voices for Peace and a member of the board, the national board, we have lots of friends and acquaintances in like-minded communities. We, and Seth mentioned that, there is a group in Richmond called the Virginians for Israeli-Palestinian Peace or something like that.
The Richmonders for Israel-Palestine Peace.
Right. So, you know, with a group, of dedicated people such as that in Richmond, the Richmonders, we were able to clearly be in visible contact on a daily basis almost for the past month now with many of the legislators in both houses. To add to that, I think it is and I mentioned the New Dominion Pact, and I know that Seth personally has good relationships with several legislators from Northern Virginia. I, as a person who worked with two governors here in Virginia and have been involved in state politics for nearly 30 years now, have as friends probably the vast majority of the Democratic members of both houses. So it was easier to communicate with these people as people who you worked with, who you associated with, who you helped, and I mean helped both organizationally and financially. So an important element in this combination would be support, political support, and but we as a group, we are nonprofits, and some of our member groups are not for profit, and they have all kinds of limitations. So we as Freedom to Boycott in Virginia, we do not support candidates or parties in any form or shape, not financial and not political. But we as individuals and member groups separate from this effort can actually make our power felt and our voices heard on a different format. And we've done it and we'll be doing it in the future.
Well, finally, Seth, your fight isn't over just yet. The coalition is busy organizing now against another bill that would condemn the BDS movement at the state Senate level. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, what we're focused on right now is actually a resolution. So the good news is that it is non-binding and has no legal effect. But of course, it does have a moral effect. And, you know, it would be used, if passed, by the Israel lobby and by Jewish groups to try to kill our own rights. So we are fighting that using the same tactics. And we know that this is going to be an ongoing battle. So that'll come up in the Senate probably in the next week. And we have another action alert out. We have calls being made. And we will, you know, keep fighting. But I think building on what Saba said, I mean, this is proving how important it is that all of the groups working to support Palestinians and to end the occupation, we have to be active, you know, in our states. You know, we need to get our legislators to know who we are, and we need them to know that they can no longer rubber stamp these resolutions and bills in support of Israel.
All right. And if people want to learn more and get in touch with the Freedom to Boycott in Virginia Coalition, how can they do that?
We're on Facebook, or they can email us at freedomtoboycottva@outlook.com.
Great. All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there, but we are going to keep watching the situation in Virginia and, of course, situations in states all over the country. Where activists are fighting to protect the right to free speech and the right to boycott. That's the voice of Seth Morrison and Saba Shami. They are with the Freedom to Boycott in Virginia Coalition, and we'll have a link to their Facebook page on the Electronic Intifada. Thank you both, Seth and Saba, so much for joining us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you. It's our pleasure.
That's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who examines the environmental conflicts in Honduras that led to the March 3rd assassination of indigenous rights leader Berta Cáceres. Gretchen Borschelt of the National Women's Law Center, who discusses what's at stake for reproductive rights in a case challenging a Texas abortion law recently heard before the U.S. Supreme Court. And Michael Winston, former executive at Countrywide Financial and co-founder of Bank Whistleblowers United, who talks about his group's plan to challenge presidential candidates to forswear dirty Wall Street money. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon angered human rights monitors when he cited the international organization's legal immunity in rejecting compensation claims by thousands of cholera victims in Haiti. A class action lawsuit is pending against the UN, filed by the Boston-based Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti on behalf of 5,000 Haitian cholera victims. The lawsuit calls for the UN to install a national water and sanitation system, pay compensation to the victims, and make a public apology for wrongful acts. Thus far, Ban Ki-moon has refused to take responsibility for the 2010 cholera outbreak that has been linked to poor sanitation among UN peacekeepers from Nepal. According to the Guardian newspaper, over 9,000 Haitians died in the cholera outbreak, and 750,000 others were treated for the disease. Five United Nations human rights rapporteurs blasted the Secretary General, asserting that Ban Ki-moon's claim of immunity undermines the reputation of the UN and calls into question the ethical framework within which the peacekeepers operate. Millions of Americans went to the polls on Super Tuesday to pick their party's candidates to run for president. But 6 million ex-offenders have lost their voting rights, including 2 million African Americans. The loss of voting rights for African Americans and the rapid expansion of mass incarceration has been dubbed the new Jim Crow. According to the American Prospect, voting rights for ex-offenders have been restored in some states in recent years. Although Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe relaxed some voting restoration rules, ex-felons who committed violent crimes must wait 3 years after their release to regain their voting rights. Laws are much tougher in Tennessee, where anyone convicted of certain violent or sexual crimes is permanently banned from voting. Voting restrictions for ex-offenders were also relaxed in Wyoming, where the Department of Corrections must now issue a certificate of voting rights to first-time nonviolent offenders after their release from prison. Prior to this change, first-time nonviolent offenders in Wyoming could only apply to have their voting rights restored 5 years after completing parole and probation supervision. The movement to end disenfranchisement has a broad base of support from criminal justice reform advocates and voting rights advocates alike. Both argue that denial of the right to vote is detrimental to the process of reintegrating newly released offenders into civil society. Before the arrest of serial rapist and murderer Anthony Sowell, Cleveland hospitals often let victims of sexual violence wait for hours for a rape examination. At the time, few hospital staff were trained in medical and forensic rape examinations. 2 months after Sowell's arrest, Cleveland Mayor Frank Jackson formed the Special Commission on Missing Persons and Sex Crimes Investigation. The commission's report, issued on May 30, 2010, proposed 26 recommendations for handling these issues differently, including adding a countywide missing persons bureau. Soon afterwards, the Cleveland Police Department revived the Sex Crimes and Special Victims Units and built stronger ties with advocates for rape victims. Police Captain James McPike, who runs the Special Victims Unit, told the Christian Science Monitor, "We take a more victim-centered approach because they deserve to be treated with empathy and compassion. As they've learned more about sexual crimes and how to deal with them, Cleveland officials are increasingly being asked to speak across the country." Richard Bell, assistant county prosecutor, says, "We're trying to help other jurisdictions learn from our mistakes." Noting the similarities in other cities where rape kits weren't tested or not enough detectives were assigned to cases, so that rape investigations were regularly shut down when they should have been kept open. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The Central American nation of Honduras is well known for having one of the highest murder rates in the world. That includes violence attributed to narco-trafficking, gang conflicts, and street crime. But Honduras is also the most dangerous country for environmentalists, where 116 eco-activists were killed in 2014, many of them defending indigenous communities and lands. The March 3rd murder of Berta Cáceres, winner of the 2015 Goldman Environmental Prize, is the latest tragic news from Honduras. Cáceres, who was shot by two unknown assailants who broke into her home, led the Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras, or COPIN, that actively opposed the construction of a proposed dam on the Gualcarque River, an area considered sacred by the Lenca people. She had previously reported receiving numerous death threats from police, soldiers, and local landowners because of her work. The escalating violence in the country is linked by many observers to the 2009 coup that ousted the democratically elected president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya. The government, which came to power after Zelaya's overthrow with U.S. support, has since pushed to build a controversial network of dams and mining projects on indigenous land. Your reporter spoke with Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who talks about the environmental conflicts in Honduras that likely led to the assassination of Berta Cáceres and the U.S. role in the 2009 Honduras coup, which occurred when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State.
This is the single most important political assassination since the coup. And the fact that they killed Berta Cáceres is a sign that now anyone could be killed. They have not gone for the top leadership of the social movements up till now. Berta was this amazing, amazing activist, one of the most alive and loving and fun people I've ever met in my life. And there has been this long, long struggle to try to stop this dam, which is going forward, even though the rights of indigenous people to be consulted have been violated. There's been tremendous protests against the dam, peaceful protests, and tremendous repression of the Lenca people and other activists for trying to stop it. And Berta has been in the forefront of that. She was threatened for many years. Their state security forces have threatened and repressed the Lenca people. Another Lenca activist, Tomas Garcia, was shot dead by the military in the summer of 2013, and his son also shot. And Berta had been receiving death threats and threats for years, but especially in the last 2 weeks, on February 20th, there was a peaceful march to the site of the dam, and there was repression, including by U.S.-funded special forces Tigres, that the very close to the U.S. embassy, and people were forced to walk back in the dark 7 hours to get to their bus. Very, very dangerous situation. The Honduran government itself attacks Berta verbally and for her activism for many years. So we all knew this was going to happen. She knew it was going to happen. And this is a message to the social movements of the indigenous people, environmental movement, the opposition. Berta was one of what I think of as the seven or eight, the goddesses of the Honduran resistance, who is so important in terms of the resistance to the 2009 military coup that deposed democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya.
Dana Frank, do we know who is responsible for Berta's murder?
Well, there's who actually shot the gun versus who's responsible for it at the broad level. We don't know who the two gunmen were. There is an eyewitness who was also shot and wounded, Gustavo Carrillo Soto, who is being held against his will by the Honduran government. He was also shot. He was held. He's still being detained within the country. And he was held without food and water, even though he was covered in his bloody clothes and had been wounded. And he has already testified to outsiders in a letter that he saw evidence being destroyed. First of all, we have to understand that there's to even find out what happened, there's already a cover-up and destruction of evidence going on. So we don't know who actually fired the shots. We do know that the Honduran government wasn't providing her with adequate protection as mandated by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. We know that this is a government that ignored threats. We know that the U.S. Embassy didn't stop do things they should have done to stop the threats. We know that this is a government that has repeatedly attacked her and Copin, that this is a government that's now trying to criminalize the members of Copin, her organization, and act like they committed the crime. They have a cover-up already, and even saying things like it was a crime of passion, which is, of course, preposterous in this context. So who's responsible? How about the top of the Honduran government, which has been attacking these folks, been attacking them with state security forces, and the U.S. government for funding those security forces over and over again, and even increasing them in recent years, despite all this documented evidence. So who's responsible? It goes way back, and it goes way high.
As many of our listeners are aware, there was a military coup in Honduras in 2009, in the first year of the Obama administration. Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State at the time. And Dana, I would ask you to tell our listeners what's important for Americans to know about the role of the United States in our policies toward Honduras during the time of the coup and after the coup.
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, people need to know that the U.S., while we don't have the smoking gun showing that they prompted the coup, immediately treated the post-coup de facto dictator president, Roberto Micheletti, as a legitimate president. They equated him with the deposed president and established negotiations where they treated them as equals. It never denounced the spectacular post-coup repression of the huge opposition that rose up. Now, Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State during that period, and you can read her emails. You can see her statements on the public record of how she treated Zelaya like a bad child for trying to return to his own country, of which he was the democratically elected president. And so I think people need to know this about Hillary Clinton. And they also need to understand that it was Obama who allowed her to do that. And it's Obama who's in charge right now, whose budget request for 2016, and which much of it which has passed, was hundreds of millions of dollars for the Honduran government, including its state security forces, and is now just putting in his budget request for 2017, increasing that even more, despite the spectacular corruption of the police and military. And, you know, we're not hearing demands to suspend the aid, although there have been letters from up to 90 members of Congress in the last few years saying that all police and military aid should be suspended, which is what we should be asking for right now.
That was Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Learn more about the environmental conflicts in Honduras and the life and struggles of indigenous leader Berta Cáceres by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Texas law passed in 2013 that has severely restricted women's access to abortion was appealed and reached the Supreme Court this term, where both sides argued their case on March 2nd. The law required doctors performing abortions to be given admitting privileges at local hospitals, while also requiring abortion clinics to meet the standards of ambulatory surgical centers. Similar legislation has passed in many other states. Supporters of these laws maintain that they were implemented to protect women's health. But women's health providers and advocates say such laws have had the opposite effect by denying women constitutionally protected health care. The High Court's ruling in the Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt case could come any time up through the end of the court's term this June. In 2012, Texas had 41 abortion clinics open, serving most of the state. Now Texas has only 19 operating clinics, and that number would be reduced to 9 if the restrictive abortion law being challenged takes effect. By implementing the so-called targeted regulation of abortion providers or TRAP laws, Republican governors and legislatures across the U.S. have succeeded in eroding abortion rights over the past several years. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Gretchen Borschelt, Vice President for Reproductive Rights and Health at the National Women's Law Center. Here she explains why this case is considered the most important for reproductive health in a generation, and what ruling she expects from the Supreme Court after it lost its most conservative member, Antonin Scalia, who died in February.
The question that's at issue in this case that's before the court right now, is how far states can go in their attempts to make it difficult or even impossible for women to exercise their constitutional right to abortion. Now, we know that for over 40 years, the Supreme Court has made it clear that women have a constitutionally protected right to decide whether to obtain an abortion. And the last major case on that decision was in 1992, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and the Supreme Court said states can't pass laws that impose an undue burden on that right. Since that decision in 1992, we've seen state lawmakers try to make an end run around those protections and advance laws that are really designed to shut down clinics and make it impossible for women to get the essential reproductive health care they need. And that's what's at stake here. What does that standard that the court put into place in 1992, the undue burden, what does that mean for women? What constitutes an undue burden? This is really the court's first major wrestling with that question since it set the standard into place.
The Supreme Court just issued a stay against the enforcement of a similar law in Louisiana, which would have reduced the number of abortion facilities in the state from 4 to just 1. I guess that's at least a temporary victory for women.
So in Louisiana, they passed a requirement for admitting privileges, which is one of the restrictions at issue in the Texas case. And the Supreme Court stepped in to hold that law so that it doesn't go into effect. So it's certainly a victory for women in Louisiana who won't be left with just one clinic in the entire state. It doesn't tell us much about the way they'll come out in Texas necessarily, because those kinds of stay orders don't have an entire written decision. You don't really know what the justices are thinking. But, you know, I think it shows that these kinds of restrictions are passing across the country. It's not just in Texas. These kinds of restrictions are passing, and we really need the Supreme Court to step in here and put an end to it.
Gretchen Borschelt, we talked about this a couple of years ago when the Texas law was first passed. The biggest difference now is that there are 8 members on the Supreme Court instead of 9. Justice Antonin Scalia, who died recently, would clearly have been on the side of the Texas law in further restricting abortion rights. So now with Justice Anthony Kennedy always seeming to be the swing vote, it looks like it will either be a 4-4 tie or the justices will come down against the Texas law. Can you elaborate on those two scenarios? What would it mean for women?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I want to say we're confident that the Supreme Court is going to strike down these laws. It has long been the case that the Supreme Court has affirmed that the U.S. Constitution protects a woman's right to abortion, and there's this undue burden standard. And given what is happening with Texas, with all of these clinics shutting down, women being forced to travel 500 miles to get an abortion, not being able to access abortion at all, then it's clear that this is an undue burden. So we're confident in a 5-3 decision, even with the absence of Justice Scalia. I think that we have a victory here. If the court were to tie with a 4-4 decision, that would mean that the lower court's decision would stand, which in Texas is a terrible decision. And the clinics would close. Women would lose their ability to access abortion in this country. I don't think that that's a result that the court can really approve of. And it also would just mean that these other cases that are pending, like in Louisiana, like in Mississippi, would still be working their way up to the court. And the court is going to have to resolve this question once and for all eventually.
I was looking at data from the Guttmacher Institute about abortion trends. From 1973 to 2011, which was the most recent year for data, abortions hit a high of 1.6 million nationally in 1988. And there's been a significant drop between 2008 and 2011, which the Institute attributes to what it calls a steep drop in unintended pregnancy, which in turn is most plausibly explained by more and better contraceptive use, and not to all the anti-abortion laws being passed, which mostly went into effect after 2011. But access to birth control is also under assault, isn't it?
This isn't the only case about reproductive health that's before the court this term. There's another case that the Supreme Court is reviewing about access to a birth control and whether employers can step in and prevent women from accessing birth control. So, you know, we're seeing these kinds of efforts to interfere in a woman's decision-making, whether it's abortion, whether it's birth control, by third parties who should not be involved. You know, politicians shouldn't have a role in deciding whether women can access abortion, and your boss shouldn't have a role in deciding whether or not you use birth control. So, again, we're confident that the Supreme Court's going to step forward in both these cases and put an end to this interference in women's decision-making.
That was Gretchen Borschelt of the National Women's Law Center. Learn more about the Texas anti-abortion law and the groups working to protect women's reproductive rights by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Michael Winston had a successful career as an executive at five Fortune 100 corporations over 30 years. Most recently, when he was employed as a high-ranking executive at Countrywide Financial, he tried to stop the fraud, corruption, and deception he observed at the mortgage lender in advance of the worldwide 2008 financial collapse. His warnings were dismissed or ignored by management, and he was eventually fired. Winston subsequently took Countrywide and Bank of America to court, winning what the trial judge called an overwhelming jury verdict. Though the verdict was later overturned by an appeals court, Winston's legal fight was profiled in a Salon magazine article titled, "Wall Street's Greatest Enemy, the Man Who Knows Too Much." Now Winston, along with three other prominent eyewitnesses to high-level wrongdoing by the nation's largest financial institutions in the federal government, have founded a new group they call Bank Whistleblowers United. The four men have proposed a detailed plan to restore the rule of law to Wall Street and too-big-to-fail banks and restore the best features of the Glass-Steagall Act that used to govern bank activities. In this election year, they intend to challenge presidential candidates to make a pledge forswearing campaign contributions from the banks and executives who engaged in fraudulent behavior that triggered the 2008 financial meltdown. Your reporter spoke with Michael Winston, who describes his journey from high-level executive to whistleblower and the goals of his group's campaign to expose the links between the corrupting influence of Wall Street's dirty money and U.S. politics.
Each of the four of us, Gary Aguirre, Bill Black, Dick Bowen, and myself, saw corruption up close, personal, unmistakable, and we tried to do something about it. And the irony is, we blew the whistle. None of us, by the way, knew we were blowing the whistle when we blew it. We just thought we were doing our jobs, which was telling management what they were doing that was unlawful. And we connected just because of shared frustration with the use of the word, any round word except fraud, whether it's the people who did this were either reckless or had loose standards or were greedy. No, they were committing fraud. And all of us saw it, and all of us tried to do something about it. I took my company, Countrywide Financial, and then Bank of America to court, and I won an overwhelming jury verdict. By the way, all of us won, and somehow it was lost a couple of years later with no new evidence and just the unmistakable stench of graft, corruption, backroom deals, and payoff. And we see that nothing has really changed in the 8 years. Nothing put in place to protect a recurrence of the same securities violations, securities fraud, and just foul business practices that led to the greatest unpunished white-collar crime in history.
Tell our listeners what your group, Whistleblowers United, will be doing this election season and your goals in confronting presidential candidates with the pledge you're asking them to sign?
Well, number one, every single person running for office has indicated their distaste for what went on in Wall Street and their determination to thwart the recurrence of it. We're simply asking these same people who say they are committed to eradicating graft and corruption and fraud, we're asking them to simply not take campaign donations from those companies or those executives who committed that fraud. Seems pretty simple to us. If you are running for high office and you say you speak heavily of your disdain for those practices, why would you accept money from those people? But we're going further. We submitted a 20-point plan to restore the rule of law across the country and on Wall Street in particular. Because what we've seen is that the white-collar criminals have not been punished at all, but those people who surface their criminality, called whistleblowers, have been punished in every conceivable ways and many inconceivable ways. So we want to fix it so that it doesn't happen again and again and again.
Well, Michael, in your view, what legislation needs to be put in place, or what kinds of enforcement needs to be beefed up to avoid a repeat of the financial calamity this country and the world went through in 2008?
Yeah, I don't think any new legislation, I don't think any new laws. I think we need to enforce the laws that are on the books. And I think the people who committed fraud, systemic, blatant, in-your-face fraud ought to be punished for it. What we know is that if people are rewarded for something, they'll do it again. If they're punished for it, they're likely to stop doing it. Well, all the architects of the 2007 and 2008 fraud have been essentially rewarded. They got to keep the money they heisted, and none of them did jail time. So it's likely the next generation or that generation is planning their next scheme. Obviously, forewarned is forearmed, but these are very smart people. I mean, look at The Big Short. And, you know, we want to inform and alert those who commit that we're going to be watching them and that others are going to be better educated in watching them so that it doesn't happen again. Yeah, I think of all the legislation and the regulations that were introduced, almost every one of them was gutted to such an extent that it is barely recognizable. Most people in financial services are honest, upstanding, try to do the right thing. So I'm talking about maybe a tenth of 1%. But those people who are intent on committing fraud and doing harm to the economy are going to do it, and they're plotting their moves right now as we speak.
That was Michael Winston, a former high-ranking executive at Countrywide Financial and a co-founder of the group Bank Whistleblowers United. Learn more about the Whistleblowers Group by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Voting for your pain. An election is occurring tonight. It's a primary, one of dozens to come. It matters not where, or, for the most part, even who. Elections are public expressions of emotion, as in, who do you like? Who do you feel like voting for? Millions of dollars are spent on massive advertising campaigns, built to bend your emotions, play to your fears, or evoke your deepest hatreds. Few have plans for your hopes. Fewer still have a handle on your dreams. We have become accustomed to voting for lesser evils, forgetting the obvious truth that the lesser evil is still evil. So we end up voting for wars we don't want, policies we don't support, and people who you don't like. Essentially, we settle and wonder why things go from bad to worse. Each candidate promises the moon and barely delivers dust, and that is the nature of the beast. The U.S. political system wasn't designed to represent the people. It was constructed to represent the propertied, the well-to-do, elites. A system was built to support the interests of a wealthy minority. The people, in the words of one of the so-called founders, Gouverneur Morris of Pennsylvania, were seen as a riotous mob which filled him with fear and trembling. You really think that founders like these ever wanted the mob to vote, ever? That spirit, the fear of the mob, may be seen today in the increasing efforts to deprive more and more people of the so-called right to vote, not to mention giving them someone to vote for. For over 70 years, it allowed primarily southern states to develop practices that demanded that blacks pass literacy tests, bean counting tests, and noxious grandfather clauses, which allowed one to vote only if one's grandfather voted, which, if one's grandfather was a slave, their grandchildren were barred from voting forever. Today, voting itself has become a lesser evil, a process that preserves the power of the propertied and the economic privileges of the elites. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
What lessons have been learned 5 years after what nuclear expert Arnie Gunderson called the biggest industrial catastrophe in the history of mankind? Are world leaders, environmentalists, and philanthropists like Bill Gates embracing nuclear power as a necessary evil for coping with climate change? How have Japanese authorities, U.S. authorities, and the press conspired to cover up the Fukushima tragedy? What are the roots of the culture of secrecy and concealment surrounding the Fukushima disaster and the nuclear industry generally? What do the citizens of Earth have to do to break free from the mindset that brought us Fukushima and other technological nightmares? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we mark the 5th anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Our guests are Linda Pence-Gunter of the environmental advocacy group Beyond Nuclear, and Earth activist and founder of Radcast, Mimi Gurman. On this week's program, Fukushima at 5, reflections on the crime, the cover-up, and the future of nuclear. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 11th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In February, Goldman Sachs warned that in the case of Brexit, the pound sterling, quote, could lose 20% of its value, unquote. Mark Carney's statements at the House of Commons not only point in the same direction, they also provide legitimacy and credibility to Goldman's assessment. As an institutional speculator, Goldman's intent is to influence expectations regarding financial markets, backed by authoritative statements from the Bank of England. The important question, which the British media has not addressed, what is the relationship between Mark Carney and Goldman Sachs? Is there a Trojan horse within the Bank of England with Goldman Sachs sitting on the inside? That comes from the article, Who Controls the Central Banks? Mark Carney, Governor of the Bank of Goldman Sachs, by Professor Michel Chalsadovsky, posted March 9th. Now with ISIS forestalled around Palmyra and Koryatin, the Syrian armed forces are in position to conduct their highly anticipated desert offensive to reclaim this oil-rich part of central Syria. Leading the way for the Syrian Arab Army are the prominent commanders of the Tiger Forces, Colonel Suhail al-Hassan and Colonel Shadi al-Ismail. Fighting alongside the Tiger Forces and the Syrian Arab Army's 67th Brigade of the 18th Tank Division will be the powerful pro-government paramilitary factions Liwa Sukur, Al-Sahra, that's the Desert Hawks Brigade, Dara Kalamun, or the Kalamun Shield, the National Defense Forces, or NDF, the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, and Katebat al-Ba'ath, or the al-Ba'ath battalions. In addition to the Syrian forces, a number of foreign groups are participating in the operations to liberate Palmyra, including Hezbollah, which is Lebanese, Harakat al-Nujaba, which is Iraqi, Liwa al-Badr, which is Iraqi, Liwa Imam Ali, which is Iraqi, and Katebat Hezbollah, which is also Iraqi. Overseeing all of the desert operations will be the military advisors from the Russian Marines and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. That comes from the article, The Desert Offensive Against the Islamic State, Massive Deployment of Syrian Hezbollah and Russian Forces, by Leith Fadel, posted March 9th, originally appearing at Al-Mazdar News. As Bloomberg reports, the dynamic circuit breaker on the Osaka Securities Exchange was activated at 12:32 p.m. and was applied to March contracts, according to Masaki Takahashi, who works in the market management department at the Osaka Securities Exchange. The website of the OSE, parent Japan Exchange's website, said the circuit breaker is triggered, quote, to temporarily halt trading in order to allow investors to calm down when the market is overly volatile, unquote. The reason for the trading halt is that a day after sliding to the lowest yield on record, on Wednesday, the benchmark 10-year bond tumbled, pushing yields up 8 basis points to minus 0.015% as of 2:51 p.m. Yields rebounded after dropping more than 5 basis points to a record minus 0.1% Tuesday. The sell-off was triggered after an increase in selling into the BOJ's POMO, when the bid-to-cover ratio for debt with 10 to 20 years to maturity rose to 3.58 from 2.93 last week, indicating stronger investor demand to sell and that investors were looking to offload inventory to the BOJ. That comes from the article, Record Financial Collapse, Plunge in Japan's Government Bonds Triggers Circuit Breaker, Halts Market, by Tyler Durden, posted March 9th, originally appearing in Zero Hedge. While the BIS report provides a good rundown of recent events in the financial markets, it fails to blame central banks for any of the problems for which they alone are responsible. The sluggish performance of the global economy, the massive debt overhang, and the erratic behavior of the stock market are all directly attributable to the cheap money policies coordinated and implemented by central banks following the Great Recession in 2008. While it's true that China is facing slower growth, oil prices are plunging, emerging markets have been battered by the capital flight, and yields on junk bonds are relentlessly rising, it's also true that central bank policy is not primarily designed to address these problems, but to ensure the continued profitability of its main constituents, the big banks and mega corporations. Keep in mind the global economy has been sputtering for the last 6 years, but the BIS has only expressed alarm just recently. What's changed is profits are down, and when profits are down, Wall Street and its corporate allies lean on the central banks to work the levers to improve conditions. That comes from the article, A Warning from the Bank for International Settlements, The Calm Before the Storm, by Mike Whitney, posted March 10th, originally appearing at Counterpunch. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. March 11th, 2011 is a date that will, or should, live in infamy. On that day, at 2:46 local time, a magnitude 9.0 earthquake struck off the east coast of the Japanese island of Honshu. The resulting tsunami crashed into the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power facility in the Fukushima prefecture. The tsunami inundated and disabled the diesel generators operating the cooling pumps. These failures would lead to meltdowns in three of the reactor units. In the days that followed, zirconium in the cladding, or outer layers of the fuel rods, oxidized in the presence of the superheated water vapor. That chemical reaction released hydrogen gas, which got vented out into the secondary containment buildings of units 1 through 4 and exploded on contact with the ambient air, causing damage to each unit. Without adequate cooling, the fuel rods in units 1 through 3 melted through the reaction pressure vessels and is believed to be resting on the concrete at the bottom of the primary containment vessels of each unit. Authorities have been injecting fresh water and seawater into the damaged structures in order to keep the material cool. However, that contaminated water has been leaking out into the Pacific Ocean for years. Authorities began evacuations, which would ultimately extend to a 30-kilometer radius around the facility. Concerns have been raised about how the strong ocean currents off the coast of Fukushima Prefecture can move that radioactive material all the way to the west coast of North America. These concerns included declining numbers of sockeye salmon off the coasts of British Columbia and Alaska, very high levels of cesium-137 and plankton living in the waters of the Pacific Ocean between Hawaii and the West Coast, and a Stanford University study which found every single bluefin tuna that it examined off the coast of California contaminated with the same radionuclide. Radiation levels have increased all over North America, but especially the West Coast of North America. Ominously, the wider public has been kept in the dark about the impacts of this disaster. The independent journalist, Patrick Penry, details through the numerous Nuclear Regulatory Commission documents he uncovered through Freedom of Information requests that the scale of the disaster was much broader than previously thought. In particular, the documentation reveals that concern was being expressed about whether the spent fuel rods in Units 3 and 4 had experienced a Zirk fire and might burn through the concrete at the bottom of the containment vessel. In a free online document, he alleges a provable multi-agency cover-up of the Fukushima tragedy. The anti-nuclear activist Linda Pence Gunter recently wrote an article called No Bliss in This Ignorance, The Great Fukushima Nuclear Cover-Up, in which he detailed a number of efforts on the part of the Japanese government to conceal the dangers springing from the nuclear accident. They include deliberately exposing citizens, including children, to radiation limits 20 times higher than the internationally accepted norm, individuals evacuated to regions where the radiation levels were even higher, and now people being repatriated back to Fukushima as the government prepares to lift compensation to evacuees. I had a chance to speak with this author about the current state of the nuclear industry and about how it and human society is adapting to this 5-year-old nuclear disaster. So joining me now is Linda Pence-Gunter. She is the international specialist at Beyond Nuclear, a Tacoma Park, Maryland-based environmental advocacy group. She's written several articles for Counterpunch, as well as other publications. And, well, we're going to just talk a bit on the occasion of the fifth anniversary of the Fukushima Daiichi tragedy. So thank you very much for joining us, Linda Pence-Gunter.
Thank you, Michael.
According to Linda Pence-Gunter, Beyond Nuclear was conceived to reach beyond the traditional anti-nuclear movement out to the wider environmental movement, which is principally concerned with climate change, and break through the silos that separate those two movements, as well as provide resources to educate, motivate, and mobilize activists on the ground. I asked Ms. Gunter to comment on the extent to which some of those activists, like the prominent British author and commentator George Monbiot, may be tempted to embrace nuclear as a clean energy substitute for fossil fuels.
Well, there are a lot of difference of thoughts floating around, because I think, you know, what you started to talk about was the climate change movement, and that's one thing. And I think that in that movement, the focus, I mean, in a way, the fact that nuclear has not been part of that discussion is a good sign, because it's frankly just irrelevant. And so for the climate movement, their focus has been on getting rid of coal, and then a lot of focus has been on fracking and natural gas, and how to go the 100% renewable energy efficiency route without depending on fracking and natural gas instead of the other fossil fuels. And they really haven't sort of gone either way on the nuclear power thing, because when you look at what's actually happening in the world, nuclear power is in decline. I mean, it's financially incredibly burdensome. Utilities are closing their plants. Investments are down. Where the money's going is into wind and solar and renewable energy, so small hydro, geothermal. You referenced Monbiot. There have been some sort of high-profile people who have, in the name of climate change, appeared to endorse nuclear power. I mean, I take, you know, one of my pet peeves, although not everybody agrees with me, is that if you actually endorse nuclear power, you have to call yourself a former environmentalist. Because unless we're going to redefine that word, I don't see how you can be an environmentalist and support an extractive industry that contaminates the air and water potentially indefinitely, you know, from the mining through the milling, the processing, the construction of nuclear power plants and the waste, and potentially sets up a risk that could leave vast areas uninhabitable for millennia. I mean, that's not environmentalism in my view. You know, if you're going to support an extractive industry like nuclear energy that could lay waste to vast areas indefinitely with radioactive contamination, then what's to say you shouldn't support coal or fracking? I mean, you know, it just doesn't fit the parameters of the definition of the word. Mm. So I think they've departed from environmentalism, but it's a sort of, you know, panic reaction to the very, very extremely urgent case of climate change. I mean, clearly that is our emergency, and we do need to deal with it. But I don't think that there's a valid argument for dealing it with nuclear. Even if it didn't have the waste problems and the meltdown risks, it just takes too long, and it's too expensive and too slow. And, you know, with distributed generation coming on, it's just not flexible. It can't come online quickly. You know, they have to shut down the refueling. It's just a sort of dinosaur industry that has some very high-profile boosters who are not going to let it go away. And unfortunately, people like Bill Gates, who want to throw billions of dollars into researching future projects, I mean, we just don't have time.
I want to turn our attention more intensely on the situation in Japan, because yeah, that is a situation where there is a major cover-up of the impacts. I mean, there were efforts taken by the government to essentially effectively undermine the welfare of the Japanese population, apparently in defense of the industry.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about, well, first of all, like what happened there. So, for example, I understand that they, after the incident, they raised the acceptable radiation levels.
Right. I mean, there were a number of things that happened, obviously. I mean, even starting before we even hesitate to refer to it as an accident, because it was entirely preventable.
Man-made.
And, of course, the study that was done on behalf of the Japanese Diet
concluded that it was a collusion of government, industry, and regulator that caused this to happen in the first place. But after it did, there were a number of things that went on, and I think it's all to do with trying to sort of minimize the idea of the harm that radiation can cause. We call it sort of normalizing it. You're trying to say, well, okay, so we'll just make 20 millisieverts a year exposure the acceptable rate now instead of 2, and so then we don't have to move as many people, but it has nothing to do with medicine or science. You know, it's a way of sort of trying to normalize it and say, well, now we'll just accept that this is okay. And also with the evacuation, people were told that, you know, it's more dangerous to evacuate than to be exposed to radiation, were kept in places far too long before they evacuated. Then the evacuation was so chaotic that people moved into areas which were actually more radioactive because of the plume pathways. No one really knew which way things were going. So they moved into areas that were, in fact, more dangerous than the ones they had left. And according to Naoto Kan, who was the prime minister at the time of the accident and is now an advocate for the end of nuclear power, and others who are speaking out, there was just this sort of conspiracy of silence, particularly between the government and the media, sort of just toe the party line, tell the public what the government's telling you, keep quiet about what the damage really means, and then kind of present this as something that can be cleaned up, you know. I mean, that's the
just
that we can
just scoop up the topsoil and move it somewhere else.
Yeah, and ignore what nature actually does and what happens when rivers come down from mountains or, you know, rain falls on trees. It just doesn't sort of, and not looking at Chernobyl and what happened there in terms of the ecology and the studies that are being done, which is sort of a foretaste of what we can anticipate in Japan. So I think that that's not unique to Japan. There were certainly some things that were unique to Japan from a cultural perspective, you know, how things are handled, but others that are probably not unique to Japan. And so we're definitely concerned that here the path is being paved for a similar kind of setup. We've got moves afoot now to revisit our radiation standards, possibly make them weaker so that if and when a disaster of that kind happens here, the standards will already be in place to allow for greater exposures than there are now. There is a push to revisit hormesis, which is basically this idea that a little radiation, in fact, is good for you. There's lots of sort of myths sown about, well, you know, if you live in Denver or eat bananas or whatever, you're already getting exposed to radiation, but that's not the same kind of radiation. Flying in an airplane is cosmic radiation. It goes in and out of your body. This kind of radiation exposure from accidents, you know, it binds to your organs. It binds the strontium will bind into your bones. So it changes DNA, causes birth defects and generations ahead. So you know, that all these myths abounded in Japan in a society which was used to sort of just doing what it's told. Mm-hmm. And I think the most telling thing really was the demonstrations that started to take place. That was kind of unprecedented to see that many people in the street demonstrating about anything, and particularly something like this. So there's now, I think, a little bit of a sort of scales off the eyes experience there where people are saying, you know, we trusted that this would be, when the plant came, we thought, great, you know, jobs. No one told us what the dangers are. And that's true even here, I think, in Canada and the U.S., people have no idea what this stuff is, or you can't see it, taste it, smell it. No one really knows what it does.
Yeah. Well, just as an example of that, I understand there is a study that was done where they were looking at tuna off the coast of California, and they found that all of it contained radioactive cesium-137.
Yes, I mean, I'm not familiar with the details of that study, but obviously we know that it biomagnifies, you know, through the food chain. So, and tuna top of the fish food chain. So obviously, yes, you would expect they're the right fish to look at because that's where you'd see the highest concentrations. I think there's a big concern about what might get into the food supply, clearly. it doesn't, you know, this idea that it wasn't really a big deal and it's over now and everyone can move back and no one died is just an incredibly shallow effort to normalize and neutralize what is in fact a catastrophic impact, not only in Japan, but around the world, and can happen again and will if we don't learn the lessons and we appear unwilling to do so.
Yeah, I understand. And I think probably a critical thing, too, is that, I mean, in terms of repatriating people, the government doesn't seem to feel obliged to continue supporting people who have had to leave their homes in the affected area. And they're saying that it's – so people are – there's an incentive to come back to an area where people probably shouldn't be living.
Right. Well, it's a sort of weird, reverse incentive in the sense that their subsidies will be removed, you know, that they will lose their subsidies, so they will be forced to go back in order to survive financially. And I think, as far as I can tell from sort of looking into this a bit, is that it's also to do with sort of economics. I mean, it's all to do with economics and the idea of these prefectures, you know, are not going to survive economically unless they have residents from whom they can levy income tax, you know, and residence tax. And if there's no one living there, they can't do it. So it's a way to sort of restart these economies within the areas that had been evacuated and has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not they're genuinely safe for people to live in. So they're being almost sort of, you know, blackmailed back, I think, by having the prospect of their subsidy taken away, even though what they're being asked to move back into, there's absolutely no certainty about the safety for anyone to live there. And so what's happening is that the people who are moving back are the elderly who think, well, I want to die where I'm grew up, and also the disease would probably outlive them anyway if they were to get any of the illnesses caused by the exposures to radiation. So that doesn't help the economy because they're retired, they're not going to have income. So it's a big problem. So that's why they've been trying to sort of lure young people by these sort of shiny, happy people kind of infomercials they've been doing to say, look, it'll be wonderful and you should come and you'll be making this great contribution to restarting this area. And it'll be interesting to see if that works.
It seems like all these initiatives, I mean, they seem I imagine to most of our listeners, it just seems downright criminal what's been taking place here and what the government is allowing. What do you find international bodies are doing or should be doing to hold them accountable? I mean, the International Atomic Energy Agency, for example, I mean, what do they have some sort of accountability?
Well, they're not going to hold anyone accountable because their whole mandate is to promote nuclear energy. And so, in fact, they're part of the problem because a lot of the information that they put out is completely misleading about, you know, the amount of radiation that's out there, the amount that can harm you and so forth. I mean, they have about the biggest conflict of interest possible. So, you know, and even the World Health Organization, unfortunately, are completely beholden to the IAEA. They're not allowed to go public about anything to do with nuclear without running it through the IAEA first. So that, you know, there's been a big move for a long time to separate the WHO off IAEA so that it can actually do independent work that's not vetted by an agency that's there to promote nuclear power. But I there are three TEPCO officials that within Japan now who are being prosecuted, and there have been calls for TEPCO to be tried. And obviously TEPCO is, you know, at the center of all this, but by no means alone, given the collusion that went on between the government, the industry, and the regulator. So the idea of anyone sort of being prosecuted or held accountable, there are three probably largely token officials from TEPCO who are going to be held accountable, but there's a lot of sense that they, you know, nothing much will happen. It's sort of a show trial almost. But, that's the criminal responsibility issues never really come up for any of these things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in a way, advocating to have nuclear power plants is sort of criminal because you know that they could kill tens of thousands of people, if not more. So that seems like the wrong thing to advocate for when you're trying to save the planet.
I guess I have maybe one final question on this point with regard to the cover-up, and that has to do with the role of media.
Yeah.
How would you, given the immensity of the problem, how would you say the media has fared as either in terms of holding power to account? Is it outright complicit?
Well, I can address the U.S. media more easily because I don't speak Japanese, so I don't know exactly, you know, I can only tell you what my colleagues in Japan have said about the Japanese media, which is that it sort of, it spouted the government line and therefore misled people. Although there have been some good, I think there's been the Asahi Shimbun for one that's actually, you know, broken rank and done some digging and been more outspoken. But what I find here, at least, is that there's, and it's been true not just for Fukushima, it was true actually during the Iraq War. And there was another lesson not learned, where it was clear that the media just bought the government line, that if you were a general or a government spokesperson in a tie, you were believable. And if you were a sort of wild-eyed peace activist, you know, you were not. And that's continued and has continued with the Fukushima disaster. I mean, I found even on our NPR, our public radio network, right after Fukushima disaster, they would have people on who were there to sort of deny the seriousness of it or downplay the impact or say that a little radiation was good for you. And to get a chance to put the other point of view continues to be very difficult. And for whatever reason, you know, they want somebody with a PhD. And when they find that person with a PhD, it's got to be somebody who's a proponent of nuclear energy and not a critic. So it's not to say they don't get on, but I think it's still extremely skewed. And there's a tendency to think, well, the government's right, so we'll have this person because he's a spokesperson from the Department of Energy, and therefore he's more believable than a spokesperson from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Well, you know, that's not true.
Okay. Well, Linda Pence Gunter, I want to thank you very much for sharing these perspectives with us, especially on the occasion of this rather tragic anniversary, and I look forward to speaking to you again at some point. Thank you.
It was a pleasure to be on.
We've been joined by Linda Pence Gunter, International Specialist at Beyond Nuclear, which is a Tacoma Park-based environmental advocacy group. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. To bring her own unique insights into the state of the Earth and human society 5 years after the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear tragedy, we're joined by Mimi Gurman. Mimi Gurman is a past guest of this program. She is a self-described Earth activist with lifelong involvement in the anti-nuclear movement. She's active with the grassroots group No Nukes Northwest and a founder of radcast.org, which monitors radiation readings worldwide. So, Mimi Gurman, welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you. 1 year later and the same old, huh?
Unfortunately, it seems. I guess I was just giving us this kind of a retrospective show. I was wondering if you could just sort of maybe either correct or amend the record a bit. What the official record is that there was a magnitude 9 earthquake which triggered the tsunami that flooded the cooling generators, thereby causing them to fail, resulting in the meltdowns of 3 of the 6 reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi facility. I'm wondering if there's anything, any new revelations about the extent of the damage to those facilities and what caused them.
Well, after 5 years, more information is finally coming out. We knew in the beginning, we meaning activists who were paying attention, that the earthquake did a lot more damage to Fukushima, to the nuke plants, than was previously, you know, talked about. Everything was about the tsunami, and the reason that I think that they let the tsunami take the brunt of it is that they got to say, well, we couldn't have predicted a tsunami. All of these were lies. It's just, you know, it's crazy to even talk about sometimes because it's just one lie after another. The earthquake created cracks in the buildings, and this was a really big problem. The tsunami followed and created its set of problems with generators and, you know, everything else that followed. The meltdown, we were told in the beginning, didn't even happen. We knew that it had, but we were all told across the world that it hadn't happened. And We now know that it was a triple meltdown and melt through and melt away. We still don't know where the corium is. So, you know, that's where we are 5 years later. We have no idea where the corium is, how deep, how massive this whole issue goes. And a lot of it's speculation and a lot of it's lies, a lot of it's deceit, a lot of it's cover up. And what we do know is that the cancer rates are already going up and they're going to continue to go up as years come.
Yes. Maybe you could talk to that, address that point, that especially specifically in Japan, what's been concealed about the hazards close to the facility. I mean, there was the immediate zone that people were evacuated from. A lot of them went to areas that, but they didn't take into consideration the amount of radiation that was hitting the mountains and ends up coming back.
Right. What you're saying is they sent everybody north. They sent them right into the plume. And it was just awful, an awful thing to witness. And so we haven't seen the bulk of the cancers yet. It takes a while to get cancer, but we're going to see it. We're starting to see the children's thyroid cases come up. That's multiplying. It's also multiplying here on the West Coast. But, you know, it's all obfuscated in lies because Abe immediately put a clampdown on information going out from Japan. Doctors weren't allowed to talk about what they were seeing. They also weren't allowed to tell their patients what they were seeing. And that was the hardest thing to deal with for me, was that you go to your doctor to find out what's wrong with you and hope to get a fix for what's wrong with you, or at least to be told the truth. And they weren't allowed to do that without risk of losing their licenses.
Yes.
That's how evil the Abe government is. It was then, and it still is now.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're, like I said at the beginning, we're still dealing with the same thing over and over again. It's just worse because Fukushima happened 5 years ago, but it's also happened every single day since that moment it all first occurred. Every single day. Over 1,000 days later, this is still going on. It's going to go on into decades and into the hundreds of years, and for whatever life remains, it's rearranged DNA. We will see that. We'll see that in Japan. We'll see that in different places across the world. And unfortunately, we won't be able to say this is clearly linked to what happened at Fukushima, the same way that we can't say definitively this is clearly linked to what happened at Chernobyl, the same way that we can't say this is clearly linked to the leakage at Hanford, or the leaks every single day at over 400 nuclear power plants across the world. You know, we don't have an actual tag that says this is from that. This is from the radiation that leaked out. And that's why nuclear power has to be shut down immediately.
I have more to speak on the nuclear point, but when you look at the way the politics of the situation and the entrenched interests that have all conspired, even extending down to that patient-doctor relationship, that there's a whole kind of culture of concealment and cover-up. That it seems it's like the prime directive that has to be protected at all costs. Or do you see any examples of contrition that might where, okay, we made a mistake, we've got to change things in some fundamental way? But
the only contrition has been with a couple of people from the Japanese government. But like that was it. It's hardly enough to even talk about. When we see it, it's important to recognize it. But overall, we have to remember that nuclear power was based on the need for nuclear war, and that was based on secrecy, and it all started with the Manhattan Project. So it was so secretive. It was a culture of secrecy. No one knew what the job was for the person that they might have bunked with. You were not allowed to speak. And that has gone right through the culture of the nuclear industry through today. It's never changed. It's never faltered. It's always been a lie.
So that
even to say that nuclear power is for an energy source, that's a lie. Nuclear power was created for the bomb. It wasn't created for an energy source.
And that has implications for the structure of institutions like the International Atomic Energy Agency and Department of Energy.
Which was created out of the lie, which perpetuates the lie. All of these International Atomic Agency, the International Nuclear, you know, anything with nuclear in its name is from the very same egg that hatched the Manhattan Project. You know, it all starts somewhere, and it all began there. And it began with secrecy, and it began with a cover-up. And that's never been broken. In fact, today, one of the things that has been unique that's happened, you know, in the last week is that we have 7 NRC engineers, Nuclear Regulatory Commission engineers, who came out against the commission, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And that's a really big deal. It's the first time that's ever happened where someone, not just someone, but 7 people came out saying that we have a big problem within the NRC and within the nuclear power structures, within nuclear power plants, and it needs to get fixed. And they said, these 7 people who really are whistleblowers, so they didn't use their names, probably for fear of their lives, you know, they can't, they said all nuclear power plants need to be shut down, like today, to fix these problems. So it won't be done. We know it won't be done. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission said right after Fukushima happened that, oh, yeah, we need to make some changes. And they actually, it seemed for a minute, might even have believed themselves in saying that they need to make changes in their own laws for protecting the people. But that was short-lived, and no sooner had they said it than they backed off saying it, saying, oh, no, we don't need that. We don't need changes. We don't need ventilation systems in our nuclear power plants. You know, everything that they said we needed, all of a sudden we didn't need. Back to the secrecy, back to the protective, you know, you can't really speak out. You can't speak out at all against nuclear power. The only people who speak out against it are us. Even the people who pretend that they're for green energy, so-called green energy, are not for green energy. They're for nuclear power. The whole program Obama thinks he's in favor of, you know, is all about bringing in new technology. New technology stands for small modular reactors. And small modular reactors are nuclear, it's nuclear power.
Mm-hmm.
It's not small, it's not inexpensive, it's deadly. You know, it's the same thing over and over again with new names. Mark Jacobson, he's, you know, people cling on to him and say, isn't he fantastic? He's an environmentalist. He's not. He's a nuclear lover. All of these people, Obama is a nuclear lover. You know, they all love this stuff. I don't know why they love this stuff. I mean, it's got to be for money, and that's it.
To what extent – sorry to interrupt, but I was just – I know that there's been a tendency to see Fukushima, that tragedy, as related to Japanese failures of the Japanese, and no doubt there have been some. But I think it's important to note that the design for those actual reactors were General Electric, by U.S.-based company. And
right. The Fukushima reactor is a GE. Mark One. And we have, I think, over 20 Mark Ones in the United States, and we have more GE boiling water reactor Mark Twos in the United States. All of these are based on a flawed design. Every single one is based on a flawed design. These designs are incredibly dangerous, and when things happen to the nuclear power plant, there's no safety mechanism. And this is what happened at Fukushima. We saw this go down. And this is what can happen at ours. And people hear that and they say, well, you know, it's not like we're going to have a tidal wave, a tsunami on the Columbia River, which is where the Washington nuclear power plant is, which is a Mark II. You know, it's based right on the Columbia River in Tri-Cities in Washington, eastern Washington. No, we're not going to have that. But if we have an earthquake that we now know can hit that area right where the Columbia Generating Station sits, There's no protective design for that plant either. It's a GE Mark II. So the Mark I's and Mark II's need to be shut down immediately. And they won't be.
How do you
know, this is the reality. It just happened in Japan. You know, isn't that convenient for everybody? It's all about convenience to stay in the mode of denial.
Yeah, there's an interesting term, denial. There's certainly an incentive from, the financial quarters and these elite-level interests to maintain business as usual. But, I mean, is it simply one wonders if there isn't some sort of a death wish here that would block you from something that's so, it's clear what the impact is. We've seen what happened in Japan, and you know, it can happen here, and there's no scientific or other reason why not.
Exactly. I do think that humans have a death wish. I think that the bulk of people in the corporate world have some form of a death wish. The things that we do to the earth that is supposed to support us, that we kill the host that supports us, that is a death wish. What else do you call that? It's not negligence. It's a death wish. When you frack and you destroy the water structures beneath the earth so that you no longer can have clean water, you can't fix those things. That's a death wish. These people know these things, the people who do them. You know, when you extract oil from the ocean, and everything goes wrong, and all the oil spills into the ocean. It's a death wish. We need our oceans. Mm-hmm. You know, the earth needs the oceans. We're one earth, you know? And so I do think that there's a major, major death wish from a lot of people on this planet.
Mm. When we look,
as part of the sickness, you know, that we have all been born into.
Yeah. In terms of the, late-breaking impacts, I know of a study that talked about tuna that's been harvested from the Pacific Ocean, and they're finding all of them containing doses of radiation. I know that Helen Caldicott, among others, are saying that and Arne Gunderson are saying that they would resist or they would not consume anything coming out of the Pacific Ocean.
That's the wisest thing to do. These are things that we've known now for over 3 years. The results started to come in, but nobody wanted to listen to them. The mainstream media didn't want to put them out because, again, it's fear. So who wants to freak out everybody?
But there's money at stake too, right?
Exactly. There's a lot of money at stake. So, you know, so they just don't tell anybody. Look at Flint, Michigan. You know, they knew. The government knew what they were doing. The governor knew he was poisoning the people. But there was money at stake. Hmm. It's the same thing. You can look anywhere and see Fukushima, the idea of Fukushima, everywhere. And it can be seen in any kind of earth tragedy. It's all the same. It's people not caring about what they're doing for money. And again, you know, what's the underlying thing? It's about no longer valuing life. At all, real life, you know, plant life, biota, you know, green structures, humanity, animals, trees. There's just it's like humans have a zero tolerance for anything alive anymore. Mm. It's very weird. It's weird to witness it.
Including themselves.
Well, yeah. Mm. Yeah. So, I saw this thing this morning. A friend of mine put it out, and I mentioned it to you, and I wanted to share it because it's
just
beautiful.
Yes, please do.
Mm-hmm. It's by someone. It's by a Japanese person named Zio. And it's called Fukushima Fallout, Falls and Quiet Raindrops. Fukushima Fallout, Falls and Quiet Raindrops. Geiger counters beep when the wind blows, shaking the nuclear dust from the trees. There is no bang or booming sound. Those exposed to the deadly mix of toxins are slowly dying, their insides burning where before there was no fire, lungs shutting down, heart murmuring and weaker with each successive exposure. No sounds. There was only billowing reactor steam that could only be heard if you were close enough. The clouds become enemies of life. Where before they brought it, now they take it from people all over the planet. It's been 2 years since the disaster started. The media still has almost a total blackout. Data is being manipulated to reflect lower, less dangerous levels of toxins emitted and already present in the environment. And to think, we voted these people in to protect us, to watch over us, to use their authority and our tax dollars to fix disasters. Now they stand helpless in the headlights of corporate greed. This was written by a Japanese person in the second year after Fukushima happened.
I know that in Japan, it's been underreported, but there's been a lot of mobilization against efforts to bring nuclear back online under the Abe government. And so I'm wondering, here in your country, the United States, there's a presidential election, and I guess I'm just kind of curious to know what is the responsible response on the part of people who don't want to be enslaved by this, what you call the idea of Fukushima, if we want to kind of break away from that whole, death cult, if that's the way to put it. How do we go about it? What do we do? How are we to orient ourselves moving forward to make some kind of a difference?
Well, the first step is to recognize two things. And the first is that any organization, at least in the United States, that is supposed to protect the people, like the Environmental Protection Agency, it won't, and it doesn't protect the people. It won't ever protect the people. It was not made to protect the people. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission or committee, that was not made to protect the people. It's what we are told is it exists so that they can monitor what's going on at nuclear power stations and then have the power stations fix whatever the problems are. That doesn't happen. They work for the nuclear industry. The EPA works for the people with the money. It's all corporations. So if we are to make any kind of changes at all, it will take a complete reconstruction and redesigning of our governmental system, which does not look like it's going to happen. Even if Bernie Sanders gets in here to become the president, which would definitely be a good start, even if that happened, people would also have to understand that when they vote for the Congress and the Senate here, they have to vote for people who do not take money from corporations. We have no people in the Congress and in the Senate who don't take money from corporations. The only person, I think, is Bernie Sanders, who doesn't do that. So there's really, until people decide that they want to come in and rearrange things, we are going to continue to see the same thing over and over again. And realistically, having a complete redo on our Senate and Congress here so that a president who could make proper changes can make those changes, realistically, boy, that's a long haul. I'm not saying it can't happen. I'm just saying I don't even know if we're going to be here due to, rapid climate change if we even could do that. Climate change is winning. And we did this. Humans made this happen. So we are now living in the results of what we created. Every single time you have a child, you perpetuate this problem at this point. There's people out there, there's children out there you could adopt, but we choose instead to perpetuate the problem by having more children. And I'm talking about today. This is all part of the problem. It's all about consumption. People aren't ready to not be consumers. Who wants to do that? So we are going to have a perpetual situation. We're going to have more Fukushimas, and they're going to come soon. you know, we're seeing higher levels of radiation right now in different parts of Europe. Things are happening all the time. England is showing higher levels of radiation. The West Coast is seeing higher levels of radiation right now, and this is still coming from Fukushima. Diablo Canyon was built on the edge of a cliff in California, Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. When that big earthquake comes here, that is in the water. So, you know, these are the things that we've done. And then we want all of a sudden to have a fix. How do we move forward? What do we do? Well, you know what? It's really too late. It's a hella too late at this point. I'm not saying, you know, don't try. We're still here, you know. And while we're here, we might as well attempt to live like better people than we were yesterday. Because why not? Why not go for the better thing than who we've been and what we've done? Because what we've done and who we've been created every single problem that we're in right now. And people like to think they didn't take part in that. Look at who you voted for.
Look at how you live. You
know, look at how you live. Look at how many cars you drive. Look at how many lights you turn on. You know, every time you turn on a light in the U.S., you're supporting the nuclear power companies. Hmm. I mean, people don't understand connection here. And here we are, completely disconnected. We are so disconnected that we have disconnected ourselves from the earth that we live on. And in the process of disconnecting from the earth, we've killed the earth.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
So it's like we were dying, but just haven't stopped moving yet.
It's quite amazing. I mean, it's really quite an amazing thing. If I were an alien and, you know, 40 years coming here to see what we've done, I'd be like, wow, why'd you guys do this? I'm serious. I mean, none of this makes any sense. And we did it all for money, which we created in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and oh, money, everybody wants money. And at the same time, most of us, 99% of us, don't have enough of it. And we struggle really hard in life. And yet, we still honor money.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's saying, hey, let's make movements to bring back trade, real trade. Like, I do this, and I'm going to give you this because this is what I know how to do. Whether it's creating a vessel that would be useful for you, like something to carry water in, or whatever it is, or plumbing, you know, and you do this. So let's barter. Nobody talks about these things because, oh, that's so not money, you know, and no matter how much people say, well, what can we do? What can we do? If you give them ideas on what they can do, they're not going to want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why that is. It's a sickness. Really, it's a sickness.
Yeah.
It's a death cult.
Yeah. And, just thinking about an old story I read once. So it was a kind of an allegory of human, basically, about the last man on earth behind these huge walls. And there were these sands that were just covering over the whole entire surface of the planet. And that at one point it got to the point where it's starting to trickle over the edge of the wall. And so, you know, the last man on earth responds by picking up a pail and a shovel and starts taking that sand and turning it into a sand castle. So the last man on earth happened to be a child. And so it's, I guess this idea of, you know, that you can still continue. You can still function instead of just, you know, saying, you know, giving into this idea that, well, we're all going to die or whatever. You can still engage in creative activity, even knowing that your demise is nigh.
Well, and the reality is we're all going to die anyway,
right?
I mean, and people like to forget that fact too. So again, if we have this awareness that we're all going to die, whether it's all together or relatively all together due to climate, or, you know, just singly one at a time, which it always is regardless of how you look at it, it's one at a time. I would think that you might want to choose to try to do something better with your time, with your life, you know. And yet again, it's not what we do. It's just not what we do.
Yeah. Let's kind of wake up to our real potential before we just fade out.
Exactly. I think if anything happens from all of this, it will be that. The last moment, the last blink, you know, is the waking up moment, and then we're gone. I do think about that as well.
Well, Mimi Gurman, in spite of the subject matter, I actually did really enjoy this conversation, and I think that many of our listeners will be, I hope that they'll be very somehow comforted by what they've heard over the course of this conversation. Thank you so much for the work you do, and thank you for sharing this time with us.
You're welcome, and I would like to send peaceful thoughts to all the people of Japan on this fifth anniversary of the largest earth tragedy that we've known since humans have been here.
Okay. We've been speaking with Mimi Gurman, earth activist and founder of radcast.org. She joined us from Portland, Oregon. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.